Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
I remember every little thing as if it happened only yesterday. I was barely 17, and I once killed a boy with a Fender guitar. I don't remember if it was a Telecaster or a Stratocaster, but I do remember that it had a heart of chrome and a voice like a horny angel. I don't remember if it was a Telecaster or a Stratocaster, but I do remember that it wasn't at all easy. It required the perfect combination of the right power chords and the precise angle from which to strike. The guitar bled for about a week afterward, and the blood was zoo, dark and rich, like wild berries. The blood of the guitar was Chuck Berry red. The guitar bled for about a week afterward, but it rung out beautifully, and I was able to play notes that I had never even heard before. So I took my guitar and I smashed it against the wall. I smashed it against the floor. I smashed it against the body of a varsity cheerleader. Smashed it against the hood of a car. Smashed it against the 1981 Harley Davidson. The Harley howled in pain. The guitar howled in heat. And I ran up the stairs to my parents' bedroom. Mommy and Daddy were sleeping in the moonlight. Slowly I opened the door, creeping in the shadows right up to the foot of their bed. I raised the guitar high above my head. And just as I was about to bring the guitar crashing down upon the center of the bed, my father woke up screaming, "Stop! Wait a minute! Stop it, boy! What do you think you're doing? That's no way to treat an expensive musical instrument!" And I said, "God damn it, Daddy! You know I love you. But you got a hell of a lot to learn about rock and roll!"
מה זה אדום, שחור וצהוב?
ט"ו בשבט.
ניצר! ניצר!
ראיתה בציימונה, לפשוט התלבשות, את המסך הריבו, החרובות באות.
ערב טוב, הערב נראה את...
נובע!
את...
נובע!
את...
It is 34 minutes after the hour of one, and this the month of June in the year of our Lord, 2011. Thank you for coming by, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, looming high above the milk packing district, here in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon, the home of all good things, people's thoughts, and ideas. It is Friday, and welcome to day 12. It's 503-505 6964, we would like to be part of today's program. If you'd like to join in, comment, weigh in, prevaricate, obfuscate. If you'd like to excoriate, if you'd like to ruminate. Something, something, something. I'm not going to make the NXS reference. Don't do it. Don't do it. You can see it forming in your brain. I'm here alongside Mr. Big Jim Willig, who is in for Dawn Taylor today.
Hello.
Dawn is, she's at parts elsewhere. She's abroad. She's roaming the earth. She's, I don't know where she is.
She's a bounty hunter.
Seriously, she could just be, like, asleep at home in her own sick. I just don't know. Here's the thing, it's always funny. Vomit is funny. Referring to vomit as sick, though, is hilarious.
Yeah.
I don't ever get tired of that. The first time I ever really heard that done well was on an episode of Beavis and Butthead, and it was when Beavis and Butthead were trying to earn money to buy, I don't know, something or other, like paint the Huff or something, and so they were washing dogs around the neighborhood, and they started by washing Tom Anderson's dog next door. And they said, you know, we're here to, like, earn money and stuff. And he did that, well, here's my cat's been rolling around in her own sick. You know, and he was just like, handed this vomit-covered cat, which I think they then put inside a washing machine or something. It was just glorious. But the phrase, rolling around in her own sick, I found to be just, it was like a little word jewel. It was like a precious linguistic gem placed on a beach for me to find.
Really, I love words like that that kind of come across your way, and you're like, "Yep, yeah, I'm instantly claiming that for my lexicon right there."
Well, we heard something the other day. It was something used as a verb. What was it? It was God. What was it? It had been turned into a verb. It was I can't run down now. I've completely failed. But it was something, you know. It was a word like renegade. It wasn't that, but it was sort of like, I was like, well, I'm just going to renegade my way on in there. And he wasn't referencing the television show of the same name. He just decided that it was a noun that needed to become a verb, and he was just going to make it, just jammed it right in there, and it worked. Let's see, it is Friday, and welcome to Day 12. Coming up today, first of all, I got like the nerdiest, and this is saying something, I got like the full-on like nerdiest email that I've received in probably days, sitting up, and it was unexpected.
Is it shiny?
Out of the blue. It is. I mean, it's just great. I mean, here's the thing. I haven't even read it all the way through. I just saw the subject line, and then I read the first sentence in the email itself, and I was like, this is gold. It's got it. And I immediately knew it had to be saved. So I'll get to that here in just a second. Let's see. Grave Watch coming up today. Snuff Watch coming up today. We'll have another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101 today, talking about the legacy of The Muppet Show. And so at the top of the show, so that was Jim Steinman. First of all, we were talking about this actually while it was playing. That Jim Steinman thing, which is from his solo album, Bad for Good.
Wow.
Which was then, and it was also then put on Bad Out of Hell 2, I think later on, as the lead in to Everything Louder Than Everything Else. And it is just, it is simultaneously like so aggro and like rocking, and it's just like so gay. And I mean, it's, you can just see him like in a cape in the studio, you know, with like the moonlight streaming in through the window, you know, and he's sort of standing on top of like a velvet chair, you know, like, you know, railing at the boom mic hanging from the ceiling while the engineer, as you just said, just sort of looks down at the control board and like feels all awkward.
It's just like, okay, so is this a good take? Does it sound good in there? Sounds good out here.
It's that moment when he says, God damn it, Daddy! And you're just sort of, you know, just, I love Jim Steinman. It's a little...
But rock isn't spoken word.
Yeah.
It's screamed.
It's just, well, that's the only way to do it.
That's like your dad trying to teach you how to rock.
That, to me, like when I picture Steinman recording that, I picture him in the same pose that I always picture Ronnie James Dio in, no matter what he's doing, which is standing on top of Bald Mountain, like railing at thunderbolts as they come down from the heavens, you know? And just as the clouds have burst, you know, there's like the downpour begins to come and the hand of doom reaches down, and he's just there, just like a man on a silver mountain, just
devoid
shouting.
Of fear.
Exactly, shouting his excoriations at all creation. So we had Jim Steinman, then it was The Muppet Show, which you did correctly identify this as being in Hebrew.
Which was incredible.
Awesome.
Yeah.
It's like one of the best things I own. I don't remember where I got that now. It was one of those things I just found. One of those things just ended up
mitzvah.
In my collection. And the best part is, like, and I don't have the video that goes with it either. Like, I've never seen that opening. I've only ever heard it.
Yeah.
And so it is just the opening, obviously, from, you know, from the Israeli version of The Muppet Show. And those guys in the middle because now I'm forgetting, and we'll talk more about this later with the Muppets, but in the American, the U.S. version, do Statler and Waldorf talk in the opening credits? Why do we always come here? I guess we'll never know. It's like a kind of torture to have to watch the show.
There is usually, like, there was different seasons they had, like, varying sections where, like, it would be like, tonight, because we have such and such a guest, we'll have a throw to this person or that person. But it does feel like there was always a Statler-Waldorf exchange during the opening sequence. Because they weren't very much on singing for the most part, I remember.
Right. And then the other thing that rotated was like their couch gag was Gonzo and the trumpet at the end, or what it was always make some weird noise.
Yeah.
So I think that must be like that, like the Israeli equivalent of Statler and Waldorf, which is just, and it's like, and it just sounds like absolute insanity, because then there's like a thing that just starts squawking, a-pay, a-pay, in the background. It makes no sense at all. It's just glorious. Today, Gravewatch, Snuffwatch, Humor Me, Comedy 101. We'll talk about the legacy of The Muppet Show, which is awesome, by the way. Before we've even done it, it's already the best thing we've ever done. Because, you know, you've done sort of single comedians or comedians, and on, you know, as we like on April 1st or whatever, we did the sort of inversion where you talked about Andy Kaufman, who you're not really a big fan of. I did not anticipate you doing The Muppet Show, so well selected,
sir.
Thank you. Let's see, what else is coming up? Big Jim Willig is tracking the following headlines for you on this Friday.
Gmail hackers target the White House. Also, Tennessee makes sharing Netflix logins a crime. And kind of scary news, heavy honeybee losses reported over the winter.
You know, my wife was suckered into... First of all, can I just say this about honey? I don't mean honey like figurative, like my wife, like actual honey, like bee honey.
Yeah.
There's this whole thing about, well, bees just seem to be vanishing. Maybe if we weren't just stealing their goddamn food all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something to be said for that. The idea of, well, you're eating that. That's great. Let me just, and just, I mean, I would imagine, like, I got a jar of honey at home. And look, it's not like I'm some environmental nutcase or whatever. But that jar, which, and I had some this morning. I had honey this morning
How do you sleep?
It's in the adorable little bear-shaped container. And so I have myself a piece of honeyed bread this morning for my breakfast. And I can tell you, occasionally, as I'm just sort of going and just squeezing like half the thing of honey onto the toast, I think it's like with Sally Struthers. She goes like, "For the price of a cup of coffee, you can feed this village for 12 years." It's like that bear. That bear of honey would probably feed like every bee.
A universe. Yeah,
it's like an Oregon for like 1,000 years. And I'm just like, oh, that's great. That's wonderful. Do we have any more peanut butter? Onto the toast. I feel like I'm committing genocide every single time I eat honey in the morning. But it's so tasty. Here's the other thing, because she's a hippie, sort of like a hidden, like, you know, it's like a hidden hippie secret something.
Secret vegan.
Exactly. There you go. That's
vegan, if you will.
But she'll go to visit these dirt covered friends of hers in Eugene, and they always take her to like some goddamn like a farmer's market, but not a farmer's market like they have here, like, you know, where it's just some like, you know, where it's just like some country fair kind of a thing, where it's just a bunch of guys selling clay pipes and their grubby faced children running around. But then she'll come home with these jars of honey because she knows that there's a few things I like. I don't have much of a sweet tooth, but I like pastries, you know, like a cinnamon roll or a cookie, and I do like honey because that was one of the things that we had in our house. We didn't have a lot of sugar in our house growing up, but honey was okay as long as it was sort of the pure, like. And my brother was a beekeeper, which is sort of awesome. It's kind of great.
The onion that is Rick Emerson never fails to just sort of leave you with a, really?
It's not even really me. It's just that my family is, like, huge. I mean, it's like they're just, you know, it's like they're real Catholic. And so they're just, you know. And so there's, like, endless, you know, relatives and siblings. So my brother was a beekeeper. So there was always a lot of honey around the house. And, what was my point? Point. Oh, but she'll go to, like, Eugene or something. And, and she'll bring back this honey from Eugene. And the deal is, like, she's never content to just bring back, like, regular. It's like Dennis Leary's, you know, he had his whole thing about, like, what flavor coffee? He's like, coffee flavored coffee. She'll bring back, it's like lavender, like, honeysuckle, you know, rose hip flavored honey, which is like, where it's just like spreading big, thick tea on your toast. You know what I mean? It's like, well, what kind of toast did you like? Chamomile, please. You know, and it's horrible.
With shades of Vegemite.
Awful. And then so that I had to go to the store and just buy the squeezable bear thing. But on the front of it, it actually says, like, this is a thing to, like, sucker, you know, to, like, idiot earth people into buying it. It just says, you know, like, 10% of the proceeds of this honey will go to help bees. You know, and that is put on the product that is sold to you by a guy who goes in there with, like, a trowel in the morning and just says, "Where's your warehouse?" You know, it'd basically just be like going to the food kitchen here, if you were a giant, just picking it up and shaking it into your oversized maw. That's great.
Oh, free soup, the best kind of soup there is. Hey, can I wash it down with some of your tears? That's also good. I love how the proceeds go to like a bee shelter. Like battered bee shelter somewhere.
And then this huge man appeared. He was blocking out the sun.
The man in white appears. He doesn't care about our plight.
Wow. All right. Somebody's calling. I don't know why. I don't know. Do we want to take this call?
Yeah.
Hold on. Let me flip a coin.
Time for...
We'll let fate decide. All right. Heads I pick up, tails I don't. All right, fair enough. All right, let's we'll just see who this is. Where's my volume control? Hello, sir or madam, is the case, maybe.
The pig says oink.
Uh-huh.
Pig says oink.
The pig indeed does say,
yes,
say oink.
The fat man has landed.
It's a cold day for pontooning.
The fox is in the den.
Says quack.
Is this the extent of your...
The chair's against the wall. John has a long beard.
Is this the entire spread of your comedic palette,
sir? Eric has soft lips.
Okay. Yeah. Is this going to go on indefinitely?
Eric has soft lips.
Bye now.
That'd be an affirmative, yeah.
Thanks so much. All right. Thank you. Thanks for joining us.
For those of you wondering, this is like, it really is a coin toss whenever the phone lines light up.
I should have
done that. Because you're
simultaneously
like, excited, like, ooh, direct feedback. And then you realize, oh, it's some asshat with a phone.
Yeah.
That's I'm going to get my 15 seconds in, too.
That's the thing. It's like this magical device where anybody who can press 7 buttons in the right order gets to talk to you. And you know, the thing is, it's been a while since we've actually had just something that was a complete and total waste of my time. So
How does it feel?
It feels like I need to be putting that phone disconnect sound effect back on the board. So I'll just get that ready. Should this become sort of a somebody's saying yes, this is yes, these calls are much better than when they were screened by Scotty J. No, that really is true. Strangely enough, still better. I don't know if you ever heard our phone disconnect. Uh-uh. I didn't have it ready because again I wasn't anticipating that. I almost wish I could recreate that now. So that's like, you know, that guy goes, whiskey garden hose, and then you just go, No, I'm sorry, I can't. And then there's a. There you go. That's awesome. The thing we used to use just to sort of get rid of people like that. No. I didn't have that. I wasn't able to do that seamlessly today, but there's always next time.
Yeah.
It's always the next time. It's the Rick Emerson radio program. Somebody says, I just saw Dawn. She's galloping in the golden fields of Way with other ponies. All right, thank you. What else are we doing? Well, that's it. So we got a Grave Watch coming up, Snuff Watch, Humor Bee, Comedy 101. Today, talk about the Muppets, those headlines, and so forth. Let's see. In just a moment, we'll talk about this comedic event that you were at last night. But I promised to read this email that just arrived. Also, I don't know why I wrote down the words. I was looking at my show notes, and I don't know why I wrote down the words Led Zeppelin. It's just like there must be. And it's not like it's anything else. It does say Led Zeppelin. I just don't remember why.
Did you forget to write rules after that?
That's right. We were going to discuss things that are awesome. I do remember why, actually. Now that I think about it, it's because our friend Keelan King was here yesterday. He was talking about his new CD, Star Pilots Lament, and the fact that he pressed it as a physical CD, not just an online thing. And we were talking about the sort of thing that you don't just, you know, what. You know, that you just don't get to do much these days, for better or worse, with the digital distribution of music. You know, it's like cover art and liner notes and little Easter egg-y things. You don't really have those like you used to. And, you know, I used to sit and stare at like the cover of the Black Sabbath's Greatest Hits, which was just awesome. If anybody out there has ever spent any time looking at the vinyl version of Black Sabbath's Greatest Hits, which is this like Hieronymus Bosch like painting. It's called Triumph of Death, and it's just this vast, which I guess is actually a painting that you can see the real thing, like, I don't know, in a country that's not this, like in Spain or where, some place where they keep art, you can see the actual painting. And it's this awesome painting where the dead have risen and then they are herding the living like into a cattle chute, presumably to be killed.
Nice.
And they've just taken over this small Spanish town. And when you're like 15, it's like the most righteous thing. Like that's, you go, art is actually kind of awesome. But I used to sit there and just while listening to the Black Sabbath's Greatest Hits record over and over again.
It's all just like fruit and buildings and stuff. I mean, this is art too? Rock!
And it's like you can't just, you know, it's like you just can't, looking at your iPad or whatever is never really the same thing. You know, in liner notes, you don't really read those. But But the best ever argument for having like physical media as opposed to like something off iTunes was the vinyl. And some of you classic rock fans in the house will know what I'm talking about. It was the vinyl version of Led Zeppelin 3, the original vinyl pressing of Led Zeppelin 3, which I swear to God, and this is not like an urban legend. This isn't one of those like Led Zeppelin urban legends. It's not, you know, that's just fake. If you actually had an early pressing of Led Zeppelin 3, which I have at home, by the way, which has the whole like die cut, like gatefold sleeve. If you take out the actual record, the actual vinyl record itself, and you look at that, there's the runoff matrix, which is that, you know, when it's done with side one and it goes and just sits at the end and just cycles.
Yeah.
If you look in the runoff matrix of the vinyl version of Led Zeppelin 3, I swear to Christ, there's an Aleister Crowley quote like scratched into it.
No way.
It's totally true. I have a copy of it at home. And that was at Jimmy Page's request, of course, because he's, you know, like a black wizard, striding around the studio again in a cloak, with a book of spells and like an incantation staff, and just
gonna wipe the sarcasm tone out of that voice, Mr. Emerson.
It was fantastic, and it says, if you look in the runoff matrix, it says, "Do what thou wilt, so meet it be." Which is like from Aleister Crowley. Like, who does that? No one.
Can we just kind of like foster a guess as to how many senior quotes that
totally
became?
Right after what a long, strange trip it's been. It's awesome. That's why I wrote down Led Zeppelin. I'm going to check that off the list now.
Done.
Excellent.
One step closer to perfection. Let me read this one other geeky thing, and then we'll talk about we'll do some what happened last night. So this is let's see. So this just arrived like moments ago. From the press office of the Rose Quarter. It says, let's see if I have... Do I have appropriately... I don't know if I have appropriately nerdy music for this. I don't have any, like... You know what I gotta get is I gotta get, like, some fanfare or something. I have to get some sort of a... I have to get some sort of, like, a... I don't know, like an entering the gates of the, like, you know, the portcullis has lifted and you are entering the gates of the kingdom, you know, kind of fanfare. Just, you know, for whenever we have, you know, like really, really like relentlessly nerdy stories.
Like a Ren Fair kind of background.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Let's see if I've actually got this here. Hold on a second. I may in fact have the music here. Hold on a second. If I can't find it like right now, I will give up, because otherwise then it's just going to be me just doing this. Hold on. Thank you.
Your listenership is important to us. Your show will return in approximately 4 seconds.
Hold on. Here we go. So I just got this email from...
See?
From the Rose Garden.
Why you gotta be like that?
It's all I had. It's all I could find. I'm not making this up, by the way. This is a press release that was just sent out by the Rose Garden. For immediate release, The Lord of the Rings in concert.
No way!
Fellowship of the Ring at the Rose Garden, October 18th.
See, they should have called it Fellowship of the Rose.
Fellowship of the Rock.
Yes!
That's tickets on sale next Friday, June 10th. Lord of the Rings. And by the way, you can tell that they're going to keep pimping this like as long as we have money, because it is titled Lord of the Rings in Concert, : The Fellowship of the Ring. Meaning, that's the first tour, followed by 2, 3, the whole suite, the director's cut, The Hobbit, Hobbit 2. Let's see.
Leonard Nimoy be opening?
Lord of the Ring, would you like to hear the description?
Please.
Here's the where and what and the how. Tuesday, October 18th, 2011, Rose Quarter. Tickets, a mere $75.
Or 2 gold shillings.
The Lord of the Rings in concert, Fellowship of the Ring, will make a stop at the Rose Garden on Tuesday, October 18th at 7:30 p.m., featuring Howard Shore's Academy Award-winning and Grammy-winning score performed live on stage by more than 200 musicians. Celebrated maestro, I swear to you, this is his name, celebrated maestro Ludwig Wiki. W-I-C-K-I.
For Luwick, as we know him on the streets.
We'll conduct all performances. Let's see. Also, Caitlin Lusk, who has toured the world as a soloist in the Lord of the Rings Symphony. It kicks off a 3-year celebration of Lord of the Rings in concert, during which each of the 3 Academy Award-winning films will be performed in concert on the 10th anniversary of its release.
Oh, my God.
So this is the first of, like, at least 3 tours coming through Portland. And then the grand finale, yes, Return of the King, in June of 2013. It must be nice to know where your money's coming from for the next decade.
Yeah.
You know, like at any point you go, my next 10 years are taken care of.
Well, it's going to take that much time to scrub the BO from the rafters and, you know, delouse every seat.
Doug Adams, let me read the description here. Let's see. I mean, I know that you feel I ought to have some, I ought to have some other music accompanying this. I'm trying to see.
That's kind of hurt a little bit.
I'm trying to see what I might have. Is there a...
A minstrel? You don't have anything with like a lute?
Yeah, I just got nothing but lute music just sitting around.
Pull out my lute folder real quick.
Hold on a second. Shuffle. Yeah, no. I've got a playlist already made up. Well, hold on. Just a goddamn it. Hold on.
Lute.
All right, you dick. All right, hold on a second. Let me just, if I just get this, get my loot on here. Hold on. All right, are we
get
all
my
are ready?
Loot on. See? Much more appropriate.
I think there's a crackling fire in the background.
Of course there is. Smell some stew cooking.
I'm not. Behold, fair maidens. We come from. No, this, I'm not feeling this. Hold on, I gotta find.
What?
I gotta find something else. Hold on. Okay, maybe if I add minstrel. That's gonna bring up something awkward, though, isn't it? All right, hold on. Minstrel.
Any old Amos and Andy cereal is gonna pop up accidentally.
You're a bad person. All right, no, hold on.
It's your playlist.
I feel good about this. I feel good about this selection. Okay, ready?
Yeah.
Here we go. This will be our, let's see. I think this is going to be, I think this might actually work. This might be what we, this might be what we need. All right, so this is, let's see. Oh, God, this is from an album called Bard Jam. All right, I swear to God, that's what this is called. Let's see.
Blind Guardian?
I mean, how do you feel about that? No. Let's see. I know this is really just taking the longest. This really is like the longest time imaginable here.
Couldn't be any longer than the books.
All right, we're only right now. We're just this one of the appendices. This is just where they're just talking about the the House of Ariel.
JR's just make shout outs.
Okay, this is really not coming together. I have failed in so many ways here. How hard can it be to find lute minstrel music on the internet? Seriously, for the love of God. Okay, seriously.
What is it being used for at this point?
I'm trying one more, and then I'm just giving up. Let's see. All right, we're just going to do... how about this? Lament of a Minstrel by the band Falconer. If this doesn't deliver, then I give up. I'm sorry. I just, No, this is not...
No,
I'm sorry. It's just we're back... I'm sorry. I hate to do this to you, but we're just back to sabotage. Anyway. What the hell was
I
doing?
See, it's people like you that have given my people such a hard time over the years.
I'm sorry. I wasn't prepared. I didn't have my, my Mannheim steamroller, my Shadow Fax collection, you know, like all ready. So, you know, maybe next time. All right. So, so we have this this press release. This is from the Rose Quarter, and the description here is actually this. It just says, "This is the description of the actual event." It reads. It not only captures Fellowship's sweeping emotion, thrilling vistas, and grand journeys, but echoes the very construction of Tolkien's Middle-earth styles, instruments, and performers. Collected around the world, this collection embodies Tolkien's culture with a unique musical imprint.
In operatic fashion, these musical worlds commingle, sometimes combining forces for a cumulative power, other times violently clashing, and always bending to the will of the One Ring and its own ominous family of themes.
I even hit the post on that. That was impressive.
It's what I do. So there you go. Family of themes, by the way. That's what they have.
I wonder if the Rose Garden, knowing just how successful this is going to be, is going to just pull out all the stops and make it like have the security have to dress in like, you know, medieval type garb. Be like, you know, like, you know, Hobbit circle seating is Shire seating is going to be a little more expensive than, you know. You know, various other types of seating, like the nosebleeds.
I think you can tell by the inclusion of phrases such as this. These live performances placed... By the way, this is just some high school kids, I think, playing the clarinet. These live performances place the score in the spotlight and create a wholly new and unique audience experience. Even our most ardent fans are amazed at how completely Shore recreates Middle-earth in music, and how the live score provides narrative clarity, structural complexity, and above all, a living heart to the story. It is truly, key phrase here, your chance to join the fellowship. So there you go. That's
and
awesome.
The good news is That's in the concession fantastic. Area, mutton will be half off. So
so that is a, by the
Wizard
way,
Wizard needs food.
Going on sale. Going on sale next Friday. Yeah, just for the and apparently the $75 though there are less expensive tickets. So it is a thing. It is accessible for you and your clan to go see. That is
journey many moons.
That's and it's going to be happening October, and then with the Two Towers, and then Return of the King every year thereafter, and then they'll just find and then it's going to be like the freaking Trans-Siberian Orchestra thing of just finding endless ways to repackage the same like four albums over and over and over again in concert every single year, so that I will pay to go see it. So and now people are just sending me nothing but medieval loop music. Who knew that so much of that actually even existed? This is. Oh, this
is
like
when, Jim Croce.
Yeah, no, this is totally. Yeah, this is like as you're getting. This is like as the guy telling me, "All right, I'm going to do a deep tissue massage here on your glutes, and then I'm going to have you exhale real slowly while I work the lumbar." And then he does that thing of twisting your head really quickly and violently and snapping your neck. All right, well let's be done with that portion of the program.
If
now.
I could save time in a magic missile.
If I could go back and remove that entire section of today's show, that's what I would do. If I could just delete time in a bottle. Somebody says, I can't make fun of this due to the fact that the Star Wars themes in concert were awesome. So, which is a thing that, they, by the way, was just here and is coming back again in like 6 months. So.
Yeah. But I mean, like, I don't know how many disco remakes... We're done. I remember the day you guys played.
Nego.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The full-on, like, 45-minute-long...
I've got the...
Star Wars Coke-addled.
I've got that. I've got the same thing of with the Superman score.
Yeah.
Where it's all like... you know? Totally. And then, like... And, like, a big, like, bongo break halfway through. You know, that just goes on... It goes on for like 12 minutes or something.
In the video, you have a guy in a Superman outfit, like seriously, like a blue blur going around with his massive totally. Bongos.
Yeah, meanwhile, while a guy in like a while, you know, like a while a guy dressed as the moon in a sparkling white suit is just ladling cocaine into everyone's nostrils and then ascending back into heaven on tethers. All right. We're no longer allowed to make fun of Jim Steinman, by the way. This is our karma for mocking him at the top of the. He's a nerd. Let's see. By the way, somebody said, you know, the Rick Emerson show after the quality assurance department gets done editing is only 23 minutes long. Thank you. All right. So, believe it or not, we're still in the beginning of the show. Gravewatch coming up today. Snuffwatch coming up today. Big Jim Willie with another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101 that we'll do the talk about the Muppet Show today and the legacy of same. I read that email. Was I going to read? Let's see. Dawn Taylor is absent today. Somebody asked where she was, and I said, I actually didn't know. It's not like she's, like, keeping me in the dark as such. I mean, she is. I'm trying not to frame it that way. And she sent me a thing. She's like, you not going to be there. See you later. Sorry, bye. Thanks. You know, and it was like four words or something. Let's see. We've got it. It says, perhaps she's out looking for a boss who doesn't constantly ridicule her on the air. Like she'll ever find that. Like that's
best of luck.
Like that's in the cards ever.
In this economy? Right.
Any turn of the karmic wheel ever in her life. Let's see. Somebody, and this one just says, this is because of Legion of News last hour, for which Jim Willig also pitched and said, beavers don't levitate. They go, we've been pwned, sir. Yeah. That's it. I'm sorry. You have check
it's
and mate.
Through us.
I'm sorry. I might as well just, I should just pull up my larynx right now and throw it down a garbage disposal.
Well, I'm going to burn all my sweet pickles information cards.
Wow. Good reference. Well
Thank
done.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. We already did the headlines and the whatever. So this is normally what we do. What happened last night? And what happened with me last night? It was me just texting you going, I guess Dawn's not going to be here. Can you, what are you doing? You don't have a life or anything. Could you come in? And I realized that that as I texted you last night that you were at this, I guess it was the first, whatever, the first bracket of the Portland. What is the actual name of the event?
The first heat. It's a 2011 Portland Comedy Contest.
And so you were in the first heat of that, and it's like a bracketed thing they do with comedians. And then you got back to me fairly soon. And then I saw you this morning, and I said, so how did the comedy thing go last night? And you said, save it for the show.
Yeah.
Which is either that's good or probably the downward inflected tone with which you're speaking indicates that maybe you had some reversals last night.
No. It was so great that I'm just burned out from even like please. Thinking about it and bringing it into words. We were in Gresham.
So always a good start to a story.
I'll just start there. We were in Gresham, and like deep Gresham too. This wasn't like, oh, the Max Line's still like, no, like you abandon like TriMet stops, and then there's just like a Sherpa standing by a corner that will like lead you to where you need to go in Gresham.
There, I got to tell you, there is no loot dirge sad enough to express what that must be like.
No, it really was. And so we go to this place called The Hideout. In Gresham, which for those who are Gresham savvy, is right next to the high school. Because you need a bar right next to a high school,
sure.
I think.
Yeah.
And so you can tailgate your illegitimate son's football games. So we show up there, and the audience, this was like night number four for the contest, and they had like running totals. And you have 15 people in each heat, of which they take the top five. And at this point, going into this night, I was overall, I was tied for sixth. So I was just outside the bubble.
Okay.
So with a good performance last night, I could have gotten in. There's one last night that'll be tomorrow in Mount Angel.
So what is the actual... what are the actual specifics of the performance? In other words, is it like you get 9 minutes on stage, or you get 12, or you get two sets
three.
Of four? Okay, so you get 3 minutes.
3 minutes.
So you're there, and it's you and a bunch of other guys. You go up, and you get 3 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and then the voting is done. Who makes the decision? Who casts the votes?
We have, I think up until this point, we had like several stable coaches, mm-hmm. and then we would take like one or two from the general audience that showed up that night. The second night at the Cedarville Inn, also in Gresham, one of the judges that were selected became insanely drunk,
uh-huh.
and was heckling the comics.
Oh my God.
And it wasn't like, you know, your standard, like, you know, you say a joke and that kind of like tickles a fancy and you kind of yell something up where you think you're trying to help. No, the heckles were like, I don't like your face. You look like Zach Galifianakis. Do you know who that is? These were the heckles. And then she was turning to her friends in the immediate area as the same performer was continuing on, whispering things, or not even whispering, just saying things like, don't laugh. Don't laugh. I don't think that's funny.
Where
so
do they get these people from? I mean, where like...
They were. This was the one that was selected from the group. We were assured that the person that was selected was actually normally fairly reliable,
a master of their craft.
Yeah, but quote was going through some stuff,
like a case of Jim Beam.
Pretty much. That was my reaction. So based on that night, though strangely enough, that was the night I did the best. I placed fourth that night.
Was it just out of sheer defiance? Like, you will not break my spirit. I will persevere.
Well, it was one of those things where the bar itself was fairly large, but the turnout was a little more sparse. And I'm the kind of guy where I don't want to sit and watch everybody else's set.
Sure.
Because, not because I don't want them to do well, but I get kind of like wrapped up in their material.
Right,
and I get kind of like distant.
You
got to
stay in show mode. You got to be
exactly.
in game face. Yeah.
Exactly. So I was outside for most of it, and then like people were coming out, and they're just like, God, they were just like telling stories about this wretched, evil woman that was just heckling the acts. And by the third comic, the guy that was running it came out and explained to us all that that person had now been removed. Their tally had been pulled, and okay. they had a backup in the event that something like that were to happen. I like how Grisham has its own like breakers in place in the event.
An enforcer.
Yeah. Yeah. So, anyway, last night was at the Hangout, also in Gresham, and pretty much a packed house, which was great. They were thoroughly liquored up and various and enjoying what other additional...
Many libations and intoxicants.
Yeah, whatever else they were into also. And it seemed like everybody was doing very well, and I had been pulling consistently... somewhere around like the 10th, 12th, you know, somewhere in that general area throughout the night and also throughout the week. This night I pulled 11th.
Now, what is the time elapsed between when you do the set and when you find out how you scored?
All the comics perform, and then they bring us all back up on stage for what we call drunken improv,
right.
Which is kind of like we do a bunch of Who's Line games where we ask for, like we play Joke Jeopardy, where we ask you for the question, or right. give us the answer, then we come up with a question for it, or World's Worst Slogan, you give us a product, we give you the slogan for it. I like my women like I like my blank. We play that until all the votes are tallied, and then we leave the stage. The MC comes back up and announces the standings for that night.
Right.
The way that they're breaking it down for the scoring is how you place each night. Like, say you're first, that's 1 point.
Okay.
And then at the end of the week, they take all your placements, add them
tally
up.
Tally them up.
Yeah, and the five lowest tallies are the top five that move on to the next.
Right.
It took a little while for because the way it was explained was kind of confusing to me, but once I figured
but I get it,
out,
like, yeah. You want to have, first place is first point, 1 point, second place is 2 points, so you want to have the lowest total. Yeah.
So based on that, I was tied for sixth, so I was just outside of the bubble to move on. And like I said, if I did well at that show, I felt I had a strong enough chance to sort of hold tight. And they have a drop night as well. So they took your lowest night, drop that off for everybody.
So you felt like you were in the running, though. Like it was within sight.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I got up on stage, and it just kind of fell apart. Mostly due to the fact that as the MC had gotten up after the last guy was done, he was getting them ramped up and was doing like the standard introduction that he gave everybody else. He was giving it to me. Like five different people from three different tables got up simultaneously and left. And it's not like we have a stage. We just have like, you know, the karaoke section of the floor to do our thing. So as my name gets called, I'm kind of like working my way past them to get to the area to start, you know.
Let me impede your rush to the exit.
Yeah. So, I mean,
That sucks.
Yeah.
That sucks.
So, I had tried to mix things up a little bit. I had a couple of different segments that I had been doing, but I wanted to flip them because the latter joke was a little faster hitting, and I wanted to get up there and hit hard, hit fast. And then the closing joke took a little bit more to build up, but the punch was really good. So I figured if I did it that way, I would do really well. Didn't happen. I got kind of thrown somehow and just kind of froze up and choked a little bit.
Well, the thing is, it's like, and that live performance, like, or just anything you're doing in front of a group, it is, it's like this gyroscope where if all is going well, then it sort of, you know, just kind of goes, it just works.
Yeah.
But it's like if you get to wobble, then it's like as it rotates, the wobble gets magnified and magnified and magnified. And this is a strange analogy. This is just my way of looking at it, and infer what ye will. My analogy for live performing has always been, not that this has ever happened to anybody in this room, but if you've ever been in the company of a lady, and actually this is not even really so much me. This is, I think Rollins was the one who actually put it this way. He had the best ever discussion of this. He talked about being with a woman, and he was not able to achieve or sustain. And he said like, you know, that's, you know, he's like, well, that's the thing, it happens. Think your way past it, or just relax and everything will like work out. He said, but that doesn't happen, because what happens is, like, then all the thoughts begin to stack up on themselves.
Yeah.
And exactly. Once all the thoughts are stacking up, he's like, then you basically just look down and you go, I guess we're just not, we should just go home. Okay, goodbye. You know, and that's the live performance thing. If it starts to go a little wobbly, it takes like a Herculean effort to like force it back into the groove. And it's possible, but it's hard. It's hard. No matter who you are, it's hard to do.
And I've done it, you know, and that's what's even more frustrating is that I've managed to do that in the past where it starts off kind of rough, but I can kind of shrug that off and like a professional kind of like, you know, get back into the mode, bring them back around. So by the time it's over with, it almost seems like it was a planned kind of guffaw, which can at times even, you know, rampant. Not this time.
Yeah.
This time didn't go well at all.
Do you find, just because I'm fascinated by this stuff, somebody, by the way, has sent me just in time. They said, play this lute dirge. It's perfect for this story. So now I was actually trying to find a lute dirge that was made just for your tale. Because I am endlessly fascinated by, you know, by other people's sort of, you know, other people's. This might be too appropriate.
It's like an Italian barbarian has been laid low in battle.
Welcome out to the Chuckle Hut. Drinks are two for one tonight. Later on.
Specialist Salisbury steak.
Later on.
Tonight we have a 2011 comedy contest. 15 of Portland's premier comedians. We're slugging it out.
This is like it's like Gregorian comedy,
which I am booked in next week. The Gregorian comedy contest.
When it comes to comedy, now, do you find that is it the nights where you're on or the nights where you're not on? Is that part almost just arbitrary, like luck of the draw? I mean, if something really, you know, I mean, if you're having a bad day or if you're having a great day or if you, you know, you bust up with your girlfriend right beforehand. I mean, there's things you can point to. You're like, well, I was having a weird night because of whatever. Yeah. But like just all things being equal as a comedian, do you find that just you are either that there's a certain magic or a groove that is either there or not for reasons that you can't explain?
Yeah, because there have been nights where I'll give you two of like the front runners for my heat. Todd Armstrong and Richard Bain. These two guys are really, I mean, they're comfortable. They can roll with the punches. You know, mic issues, audience issues aside, they can work with that and still maintain and continue on and finish strong, regardless of where they're at. They've had some nights where it's been shaky due to their placement on the roster and the sobriety or lack thereof of the audience and crowd.
Is that where you want to go first, or do you want to go? You want
it
to go
depends.
Late?
Sometimes if you go up early, the audience is still kind of like a little inattentive, so they're still slowly working into it. But other nights you go up front and they're all ready to go.
Right.
So the audience is, the judges at least, are focused and clear-headed, whereas later on they might have consumed a little bit.
Right.
I'm not going to say they've gotten, you know, inebriated or anything like that, but sometimes they get to go to the bathroom and they come back and they've missed part of your joke. So they've sort of missed part of, you know, your setup and all that. So it does tend to alter between a bunch of different variables that even the most well prepared have to kind of just sort of accept it and move on. As because like I said, the show that I did the best at, that when I placed fourth, I wouldn't say it was my best performance of the week, but I kind of had a couple of moments of improvisation on stage that kind of helped me along with my material alone. So I kind of had like a two-pronged attack for my 3 minutes. And again, it's 3 minutes. It's hard time to get to know the audience.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like you get up there, you bang, 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 and then you're done.
Well, I was, you know, a couple weeks ago when I was doing like real, real heavy promotion for the book, they had us, you know, they had Lisa and I like doing phoners with radio stations and then also doing like TV stuff. And it's like, and that, I mean, it's, and that to me is like the TV stuff is the hardest because the idea that you have to fit something in to like 85 seconds, you know, or like 4 minutes. I mean, and that is like really where it's, you know, that is the sort of thing that kind of psychs me out a little bit because you're like every second, like there's no ebb and flow.
Yeah.
It's like you get up there and it's just, you got to like, I mean, it's, and you got to, your momentum must be with you from like the first syllable. There's no like rolling into it, you know, and then gathering speed. It's like you have to be, you know, right out of the gate, you have to be at 100%, you feel like.
Yeah, it's very similar to this, wherein you're kind of expected to flip it on, and as if your sense of humor is like a light switch. And
right.
You just like, you know, clap it on and boom, you're out or off and running. It is possible to do, but
it also tends to favor comics that are just doing like kind of basic one-liner stuff too.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. That I mean, which is, I guess, there's that kind of comedy has its place. But it's like, yeah, the 3-minute format favors the you know, take my wife, please,
yeah,
guy, as opposed to somebody like you, where it's like you do the little, you have some interplay with the audience. Yeah.
So there's I think 5 different categories. There's originality, material, presence, appearance on stage. So it's mostly like if the clothing that you're wearing kind of matches your sense of humor,
right,
and who you are. Because a lot of times people will get up there and they'll put on a suit and tie and they look thoroughly uncomfortable,
right,
in their own clothes, and so they're trying to do their material, so that just doesn't quite seem to fit. So they wanted it to be, and that's been kind of a challenge for some of the comedians as well, because they just want to go up there and whatever makes them feel comfortable so that they can perform better, but that doesn't always reflect what they want. Some guys feel like they're fashion plates, but their material doesn't, you know, sort of gel with that. So that as well. So you had like all these different categories, 1 to 10, I think, was the ranking system. So like I said, going into last night, tied for 6th, totally ate it. I felt like, I mean, it wasn't like crickets the entire time. There were laughs. I did kind of finish on task and with a decent sized laugh, but I just was so shaken that by the end I wasn't believing what I was saying. And it's frustrating because sometimes it's the luck of the draw. You don't have any control over it. So if it goes poorly, you know, you just kind of like, eh, whatever. I swung the bat.
Right.
It didn't hit the ball. What are you gonna do? But in situations like that, where you know you're capable of so much better, that you just don't have a real reason as to why you couldn't get the brain and the mouth and the body to kind of all work together for the common goal that you all want,
right,
but for whatever reason it wasn't there.
Yeah, and it's such a weird dichotomy too of that it's the best and worst scenario in that there are people showing up like wanting you to make them laugh,
yeah,
which you think, well, that's great. They're here. They're already primed. But it's like, because the thing about laughter, like I can just wank about this stuff all day. The thing about laughter is that it's almost always prompted by something unexpected.
Yeah.
And so by people showing up and putting themselves in I wish to be amused, that then
summon forth the chuckle monkey.
Yeah. And it makes it so much harder just before you've even set foot on stage,
yeah,
because the element of surprise, you know, is sort of gone because they are there primed and, you know, their interest is peaked waiting for you to make them laugh. And so it's even more important for you to feel like you've sort of got like a connection with the audience or even within yourself, the groove, you know, that I always call it.
Yeah.
And it's the reason I asked about the sort of arbitrary nature of the spark or the magic or whatever is because there's this book about SNL called... it's called The First 30 Years or something. But they talked about the time that Chevy Chase came back to host after having been gone. And he had been on the show. He'd left. He'd gone down this movie career. And then he came back as a host. And they tell this really fascinating story because that night did not go very well in many, many ways. I mean, he was like dusting it up with Bill Murray backstage. And there was, you know, a lot of like tension and resentment and everything. But, you know, but that had been the case when he was there, too. So it wasn't like anything real new. But they tell this story about Lorne Michaels standing off right off stage, like off in the wings, watching the show on a monitor. And Chevy Chase, you know, there's a ladies and gentlemen, Chevy Chase. And he walks out and he starts, you know, doing his monologue and his intro for the show to the audience. And they said that backstage, Lorne Michaels is watching the monitor and that like 40 seconds into it, 40, you know, a minute into the opening, that he just said aloud to no one in particular, he just said, Chevy doesn't have it tonight. Which, yeah, is one of those, and it turned out that it was the entire show was not bad, but just it was a little off. It just, yeah, wasn't, there was just no spark there. And that is, I've always remembered that. And so when I would talk to Mike Chase, who works at the Mike and Amy show over in The Wolf, he and I would have those conversations sometimes after the show where how wasn't I like, and I would just say, it became a shorthand where I would just go like, yeah, Chevy didn't have it tonight.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just that thing where you just, for some reason, you can't get all the moving parts to coalesce for you.
Absolutely. And so, that's, like I said, that's the most frustrating part because it's difficult all the way around. And as I talk about in my act, you get to a point where you want to be a comedian and you tell anyone that this is, you know, your goal. You haven't even written joke one, but they're like, oh, you're a comedian? Well, say something funny right now. It's like, you know, if you're like, yeah, I'm going to be a guitarist in a rock and roll band, they're like, okay, well, here, grab a guitar.
Play me a riff now.
Yeah, right now. Why is it that is the case? So, because there are these preconceived notions, when you get up on stage, the audience sometimes is very combative in that, you know, oh, you think you're funny? Well, I know what makes me laugh. So unless you fit into that criteria, you're going to hear about it from me, because I feel that if you don't, I need to kind of mentor you and heckle you so that you can kind of, because that's, I think, where the heckler mentality of like, I'm helping you
right.
do better. It's like, dude, the audience didn't pay to have me come here and talk and deal with your, like, you know, crossfire kind of feedback. They came to hear me talk and try and tell jokes. With you trying to disturb that, you know, it just sort of falls apart all the way around. But without even that much of an excuse, when the comic walks off stage and he knows that he's got no one to blame but himself, and then he looks at himself and he's like, I don't know what happened. I don't know why it just like the you know, it just wouldn't do. So
but at least you got. I mean, I would say just, and this is because I don't know really what it, I don't know what it's like to do comedy. I think I've only, the closest I've ever come to that is doing, you know, where I've had to like host events or whatever. I've had to host like you know like I did this creative this convention conference thing a couple years ago, and I was the MC for the day or whatever. And there's that, but I mean that's not like. But I'm just the MC. Like they're not really expecting anything from me, so it's not really the same. But at the bare minimum, like you know, if you don't know why it didn't go well, that's still preferable to being like. To knowing that you just like failed somehow, to know that like you didn't prep, or you just didn't, you know, you didn't put the work in, or you didn't polish your material, or you know, you had one too many beers or whatever, like that. I would imagine that is worse, knowing that you just like didn't put in the work. You know, I'm probably gonna make it feel any better, but I'm just saying, like, it seems to me that if you feel like you did everything you could do and it didn't work for some unknown reason. I don't know. Maybe it sounds like that may actually still be worse. I just don't know. I don't know how.
I call it the frog in the box syndrome because previous to going on stage, I'm at my house. I'm drilling and I am timing myself to make sure that like I'm like pausing, you know, for imaginary laughs, because this would be the point where like the audience would kind of like pick up on, you know, this setup, and then you hit them with the punch, then you wait another couple seconds and you move on. You make sure that everything is kind of core enough to be around that time. And so every time I'm sitting there timing it, it's perfect. It's, you know, it's just under time, you know, with allowing for laughter and everything else. Prior to that, I was doing other shows and other gigs leading up to this. I'd say the majority of which were very, very positive. So it wasn't like I'm like, oh, just enter a contest. I used to do comedy. It's like old hats, like riding a bike. You know, I was actually putting forth the preparation that one should in order to get ready for something like this. And then to just fall into this, like, total amateur, you know, folly of like everything that you could potentially do wrong, I did twice. It's just frustrating. So I'm like the entire ride home, I am seriously just kicking myself. You know, my girlfriend's there and she feels bad, and she knows that there's nothing she can say.
Yeah, there's nothing she can do. There's no.
The best she can do is just kind of like, you know, and you can't like, you know, make other small talk. Like, well, then let's not talk about it, because then we're talking about it without talking about
it. Let's get a soda.
Yeah, that sort of thing. So we get back to the house, and she had to work today. So she's like, I'm going to go to bed. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to stay up for a while and just watch some TV and kind of like decompress and get it out of my head. So do you know what I watched to try and, you know, kind of get my head?
Apocalypse Now?
No. I watched the Anvil documentary. As I said, I was flipping through Netflix. I'm like, oh, Anvil. Oh, yeah. Well, they know my pain. Let's put that on there.
Well, so, fair enough. I you know, and again, it's not like, you know, and I... Here's the thing: it's like the irony is that I'm the irony is it's like multiple layers of whatever. Because I was going to say I am attempting to make you feel better by telling you that I know nothing will make you feel better, and thinking, but then maybe it cancels itself out, and then he'll feel fantastic. Because not nearly as bad as I used to, but I used to have those, like, you know, where it's like I would bomb the show, or like the show would just suck, or I would believe that the show sucked, which, you know, like the talk radio thing, it's actually. There's a different layer of weirdness there, because there's no audience in the studio, so it's like you don't know. Like, you're just sort of like you're flying on instruments because you can't see the ground or the people or the whatever. Or it's like, you know, we get like a terrible ratings book. You came in, apparently no one is listening to you. No, look at this. Literally no one. In fact, look, they actively turn off the radios anytime your voice is heard anywhere, even in a promo for other shows they would normally like. And so I'd be like, that's great. I'm going to go home now. And Lara would totally know. I'd come in. She's like, "How are you?" I was like, "Had a bad show. Okay." And she would be like, "Okay." And for a while, it would like weirded her out. I think initially, because she Because I think she I don't want to say she thought I was overreacting, but I think because it's not that. That sounds sort of condescending. It's just that I think that she, you know, I mean, you know, she's not a performer. She's not an entertainer. She has a job that certainly has its own kind of stress, way more than this in most objective ways. But it's like she does it, but it's not the same kind of stress. And a bad day at work for her, I shouldn't even say that, because a bad day at work for her is like when a guy hangs himself. So I shouldn't, I have no business even saying this.
Yeah.
But it's, for the most part, it is a different kind of good bad scale on which you rate things. And again, that, even saying that now, I just sound like a dick even complaining. But it's performance is, sucks when it goes badly. And I don't think she realized quite how acute it was. And after a while, she learned that I just needed to be like alone, like in a dark room, just like staring at a wall at, you know, for like 2 hours and just wondering what the hell I was even doing trying to amuse people. And that was because there was nothing that was going to make it better except.
You just need to process it
your
way. And, you know, if that be, you know, and a lot of times it seems overly dramatic to anybody outside the situation because everybody kind of deals with it differently. But more often than not, it is kind of that thing where you just kind of have to, all right, you just have to sort of sit there and wallow for a couple, for a little while. And then after a while, you know, you realize, okay, well, as a responsibility, I have to get up and I got to do it again. You know, I have to get back up on my feet and I have to sort of soldier on, continue forward. Because ultimately, it isn't that bad. One bad show does not make you or break you. It'll feel that way sometimes.
But it's like, you know what it is? It's all about the rearview mirror in that the thing, you know, like the truck that has just rear-ended you, the truck that has just hit you, you're like, wham, what was that? Oh, a truck just hit me. And you look in your rearview mirror and it fills the entire field of vision.
Yeah.
But it's like with, you know, but as you drive, you know, it's a tortured metaphor, but as you drive on, it's like it recedes and you get a sense of perspective.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, knowing that it's going to seem different in 2 days or 2 weeks doesn't help, like, that night or whatever. David Letterman said this thing. He said that he said the very worst thing for him was to bomb a show on a Friday. And he's like, then it's just sitting in your guts like all weekend.
Yeah.
Because, and he said, this is not always the case for me, but he said, you know, he's like, for him, it's like the only thing that will get rid of a bad show is when you finally do a good show. You know, and so, you know, that's, it is a unique kind of whatever you want to call it, depression or just, you know, it's a strange feeling.
Yeah. But I always hearken back to that quote from Rounders. Where Matt Damon basically says he's just like all the great poker players can barely remember their you know championship wins, but can recall with vivid clarity their colossal losses and failures.
Oh yeah.
So it's like it's almost like this unfair. Like you're doing this because you want to do good shows. You want to entertain. You want to feel like you know what you're doing is actually entertaining to people, and they're going out of their way to listen and be entertained. But ultimately, all you see is like, oh God, that show was just so wretchedly bad.
Well, and then it's like you're not only just then it's like you're just I don't even know this. I'm probably just sitting here making the problem worse. We're probably just like
it is pretty bad.
We're just like two. You know what it is? We're just like two heroin users in an apartment. No, you know what sucks about heroin? Hold on a second. There we go. Now here's what sucks about heroin.
I like that belt, by the way.
But then you feel like you know not only like you know it's like I suck and I'm untalented. And I let down all these people who relied on me to amuse them. And that was like Sarah can tell you, and I've gotten much better with it. Sarah can tell you that I used to just have these like, not as bad as like Stern and his crew of 7 to 7, or like Don Geronimo from the Don and Mike show is probably the gold standard in a weird way to me of just having these meltdowns on the air. But I used to just, you know, my whole thing was like technical problems too were the worst, where it's like I remember when we first moved from the Coin Tower over to First Avenue at CBS, and like the first day we were there, like nothing worked. Phones didn't work. Music wouldn't work. The microphone was like crackly and staticky. Just nothing worked. And, and Sarah, to her credit, you know, was like trying to, you know, and she was doing the thing of like, it's just one show. It's just, it doesn't, you know, and she said something that I know she didn't mean this way, but she herself said later, she's like, I knew that was the wrong thing to say as soon as I said it, cause it came out wrong. She's like, you know, like it's just a show, you know? And I was like, at that point I was just like, that would like trigger like this nuclear, you know, because I just, you know, because it's like you figure, well, people have got like 39 stations they could be listening through or whatever. And it's like they're choosing me and then I am just failing them over and over and over again. And, you know, but again, it's like you realize later that it's like it's just one you know, it's like the stock market. It's like one day on a whole red line that goes for an entire year, and you get perspective on it. But yeah, but it is, and it does sound overdramatic to anybody that doesn't do it.
Yeah.
But I tell people, that fear about like standing in front of people, and you know, the fear of speaking in a crowd, which is like, you know, I guess the most commonly shared phobia for people that aren't crazy.
Yeah.
You know, and people go, oh yeah, and I'm like, well, you know, like think about that, and then also like I'm setting you on fire, you know, because like that's the only way I found that you can kind of convey it to non-performers.
Yeah.
Is just to bring up that phobia of speaking in front of people and say, like, now imagine like you piss yourself while you're on stage, you know, like that's kind of what it is like. So you know. Anyway.
Yeah, but you know, like I said, there's one more show in the contest, and that's Saturday. And the rankings or the placement for the overall hasn't been listed just yet. For those of you interested in finding out just how things are going, go to Stage Left Comedy. They're pretty much the ones in charge of the 2011 Portland Comedy Contest.
Now, what's at the end? If somebody, you know, what's at stake here? What is it? Is it just
$1,000 cash?
Okay.
Then like second place, I think it's like 400, and then third place gets 200, and then I think all the way down to like fifth place. So if you make it to the finals, you're guaranteed at least like $100 through all this torture and whatnot. And the last show is at Harvey's on the main stage. So with that, I mean there is that and kind of like bragging rights for the most part, and something else to put on the resume.
Right.
But ultimately, I mean, you win contests, you don't. You know, no comedian, I think, has ever been selected for anything based on the, you know, the number of titles one owns. Ideally, it is a networking thing because we have comics coming up from or coming down from Seattle, most specifically Mike Coletta and J.R. Baird. These two guys have come down from Seattle and they're staying with a friend in Vancouver. Hilarious guys and really just like genuinely nice people. Comedy is a weird animal in that a lot of times you get these guys that are like kind of nice to you, but ultimately are just seeing what they can suck from you to make their stock go up like one millionth of a percent. If they can do it, they will. But these guys came down really, really nice guys, and they're doing solid through the contest. So I wish them well. Also, a lot of women in my group also kind of just doing it and holding it down, right? Krista Manville.
Is that unusual? I don't know if it's unusual in Portland or if it's still unusual in comedy, but the idea that there's a lot of women really doing well at it. Because that's a thing you always hear, that, you know, the chicks aren't funny, your chicks can't make it in the world of comedy or whatever. And it seems to be less true as an attitude than it used to be. But is it different here than it is elsewhere?
I feel yeah, just because Portland has such an open mind for so many different things. And I hope that doesn't come across as any kind of like a dig in that capacity. But I think if anywhere, women would be given more of a fair shake in the realm of comedy and entertainment like that. I feel that this would be the town to do it in or near. For the most part, I mean, a longtime friend, Christine Levine, she got invited to come down to L.A. to do the Comedy Store. You know, and that's huge. A lot of comics will go down there before they're ready and allow L.A. to just sort of chew them up.
Destroy them. Yeah.
And then they come back like a shell of themselves. Like, I shouldn't have done that.
Again, Letterman did that.
Yeah.
Letterman moved from Indiana to L.A. And he just got crushed, just got creamed, went back to Indiana. He's like, I'm not made for this. Like, I can't do it. And then it was later that his wife, like, encouraged him, like, you gotta try it again. We'll get a phone call here in a second. Again with the calling. Let's see. Somebody says, let's see, a couple of things about heckling. So says, yes, I'm helping my wife with her weight problem by telling her how fat she is all the time and then making oinking noises while she's eating. Jim makes all of us laugh and through most of the Rick Emerson Show audience laugh, and we're total dicks. So that is an accomplishment. Says, also, aren't bad shows like keeping your immune system strong, like promoting evolution over the inevitable stagnation of never having bad shows?
That is a very good point, something that I hadn't thought about. Because you're right. And I made this point to a couple people as well, that if all you ever do is have good shows, you're never going to grow. There is very much a part of the human psyche, which I don't know if it's just a broken piston or what, but only by hating yourself will you get better at anything.
Oh, totally. No, yeah.
You know, unless you are, and if you are a natural talent at anything, after a while, you become bored with doing it because so many people are like so impressed by it, by this thing that you can do effortlessly, then you're not really extracting any enjoyment from it.
And also, people who are natural talents, you know, a lot of times Stephen King talked about people who are freakishly gifted writers, just like from jump, and he said a lot of them lead lives of real despair because they know that they're just some genetic freak. They know that they just won a lottery, as opposed to having some talent, but then working and honing and shaping it or whatever. And it's, you know, so otherwise, I mean, because you're never going to, if you don't suck every now and again, you're never going to know how the thing works.
Yeah.
You know, you're never going to know what to carve away to make it better.
And it's the God's honest truth. And, the getting on stage is that's your gym. You know, you get up there, you can be funny in social situations. You can sit down with a pen and a pad or a computer and you can type stuff out and put it on the page. But in your mind, you don't, you're sort of seeing it through an artificial lens until you've gotten up in front of an organic group and tested it. Then only will you be able to kind of hone the craft. And that it gets frustrating after a while, especially if you're only doing it in one town. Like in Portland here, Portland is a unique cocoon when it comes to comedy because of the fact that on a whole, we're very supportive of one another. We want each other to do well. Ultimately, so that the community as a whole can grow. And then once Portland becomes big enough, then we'll become bitter and hate-filled and spite-filled.
Sure.
And then, you know, tear each other's throats out. But this is still, like, the beautiful, like, you know, blossoming stage. And it's one that I've been lucky enough to become a part of because I moved from the East Coast where, I mean, you got Philadelphia, you got New York, you got all these other places where very easily, comedy-wise or entertainment-wise, you can just disappear completely unless you have something that just shocks the world to get anyone's attention. And I come all the way out to Portland and I find this one little, like, area that just seems to you know, have fertile soil both from the audience standpoint as well as stuff to come up with on the fly. So, like I said, you do a bad show, you don't do well in a contest. All you can do is get up and do it again, only out of spite.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing too. It's like the refusal to, you know, it is like that you will not drive me out.
Yeah,
you will not make me quit. Let's see. That's hello, sir, madam, as the case may be. You're on the Rick Emerson Show. Hello.
Hello, guys. It's Mailman Rick.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Mailman Rick.
Hello. Hi, yes.
It sounds like Don's not there today.
Wait, hold on a second. My God. I need a dramatic sting over here. I need some sort of some sort of music to underscore when something dramatic takes place. You know, in the studio. My God, you're no. Don is that was a long way to go for a joke. My timing was all off there. Yes, Don is she is absent today. Mr. Big Jim Willig is filling in for Don, who will return on Monday, sir.
Okay, Jim, I got a question for you. Do you ever remember the improvisational group, the Culture Clash?
Culture Clash. I don't believe
so. Is this a thing that happened in Portland, you know, at some point in the past?
No, they're originally from the Bay Area. They're a Latino troupe, and they do various skit comedy, and they came out, they started really hitting everything in the early 90s.
Jim, you're really about the touring Latino world?
Well, yes. Everything Latino I kind of devour.
Nice.
But no, that doesn't unfortunately ring any bells. I was more geared into, I guess, Canadian-based sketch comedy groups, and obviously England.
All right, we have kind of a wonky connection here, so I'm going to, and I don't mean wonky in the. Sorry, sir, I'm losing it. I mean, it's actually
unfortunate.
We're actually we're wonky. Hey, by the way, Cheryl wants you to know that. So thank you, sir. I'm sorry, we're just
Thank you, Mike.
Phone was going all weird on me there. Cheryl wants you to know that she says I know who Culture Clash is. So I do not. I actually know very, very little about the world of comedy, relatively speaking. I am not. I know a lot of people who are just comedy nerds. I mean, they're just freaks for it.
Yeah.
And I sort of don't. And plus, I just instinctively, I just instinctively assume that most of those, and I'm not saying it's true, but I just instinctively assume that most of those groups are bad. And I don't know why that is. I think it's a total, that is a total, like, and I don't mean groups like traveling packs of Latinos. and they do travel in packs, believe you me. Things like, you know, comedy troupes or comedy groups that sort of go around and perform, I think I spent a long time just really just like living in my own bigotry and bias about that. And so as a result, I'm like 20 years behind everybody else in terms of comedy, especially in terms of like improv comedy groups or anything, because I just instinctively just disliked it without any basis for doing so, I think. So
for me, it was my dad was always an actor, so I kind of grew up loving like adult stuff, and because he was already in his 40s when he had me, like his tastes go way, way back. So I started researching like vaudeville and stuff as far back as I possibly could. And then I kind of saw how sketch comedy was like the next evolutionary step from vaudeville to kind of keep it alive, utilizing a lot of what had always worked back in the day. So because of which, that's where, you know, stuff like the Upright Citizens Brigade,
right,
and the State, because we live in the generation than we do now, where information is so much more easily transferred. That's, I think, now why sketch comedy is becoming much more of a valid entertainment source. Whereas before, you just have SNL and like sitcoms and stuff like that.
Well, sketch comedy lets you do something it lets you release basically a comedy single.
Yeah.
It lets you it gives people bite-sized pieces of comedy that are easily transmitted around. You can't just go on Facebook and post a comedy album.
Yeah.
And have somebody hear it or listen to it or appreciate it. I mean, the sketch comedy is perfect for the internet because it is, it's a quick 3.5 minute thing that immediately gets you on the same page as everybody else who just watched the quick 3.5 minute thing.
Yeah.
We should probably take a bit of a break here because we've been talking like literally for like 90 minutes. So,
nice.
which is fine. That's value for your money is what that is
it
right
really
there.
Is.
One more time, if people want to sort of follow the ongoing exploits and adventures of the competition,
I would direct them to stageleftcomedy.com. That's got the full ranking of both Heat 1, Heat 2. It'll have the the semifinals and the final round. All the venues that have that the contest will be taking place at. The last night for my Heat will be this Saturday. For those of you listening in the Mount Angel area, and I know you're many, come on out to the Beer Haus, BIERHAUS, on Main Street. And come check us out. No cover. Comics are doing 3 minutes. Come on out. Take a listen. And
what time will you be doing your
show? Starts at 9. So depending on when I pull my ranking for that night, could be anywhere. But if for 3 minutes each, it goes really, really fast.
And if anybody, if somebody needs additional motivation or whatever, I gotta tell you, 9 o'clock. That's the reason I was asking for that. Is go to Mount Angel. And, Mount Angel is a great place. It's a beautiful town. And there's actually a lot of really great restaurants right in that same area, too.
Yeah.
So you can actually kind of make a whole deal of it. You can find out more. Later at rickemersonshow.com. I'll have the links up for that and everything. All right, we should do this. We will come back. We've got more coming up today. Well, there's nothing to put a smile on everyone's face like a snuff watch, so we'll do that.
Hell yeah.
Snuff watch, grave watch. Here's the thing. Also, the grave watch involves humping. So we'll get to that. Also, Comedy 101. We'll talk about the legacy of the Muppets and more. Stay there. It's the Rick Emerson radio program. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Next trick on the volunteer. Step up for my next trick on it's lonely as hell, and there's no magic spell for a broken heart. Put me in chains, and I will escape. Better not wait up, 'cause I might be late. I can make love or disappear. For my next trick, I'll need a volunteer. Tricks have been played, and the spotlight has faded, and the plans that we made have fallen apart. It's lonely as hell, and there's no magic spell for a broken heart. I can saw a woman in two, but you won't wanna look in the box when I'm through. I can make love, we'll disappear for my next.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Somewhere in the darkness, there's a man they call the Skipper, fast asleep, dreaming of gold.
He wakes before the sun does, even though he'd rather stay in bed. Curses the cold.
darkness, there's a man they call the skipper, fast asleep, dreaming of gold.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
That was too perfect. All right. Just now, so I got all caught up listening to the Colton and the Zevon and so forth, and then getting myself a Vizo. And so just as the Colton song was coming to an end, I said, I was going to go use the bathroom, damn it. And it was actually concentric layers of funny, because like you said, well, I can fill. And then I actually said, like a dick, can you? And she said, yes, I can do 3 minutes of comedy if you need to go to the bathroom. And then I just felt like such a jerk, I couldn't take it anymore. And now I feel bad that denying you the chance to do 3 minutes of comedy. There's no right answer for me here today.
There isn't. And, well, I'll get you the dignity bucket and avert my eyes.
God almighty. Here's the thing that, like, sometimes I'll just see these messages that are like emails or whatever, they come in later, and I don't know what they're about. Guy just says, I think a todger is a penis. He says, I'd rather stick my todger in a food blender than watch that. I have no idea what he's referring to. Could have been anything. Lord of the Rings thing, maybe?
Yeah, I think that might be it.
No way to know.
It's more of like a feast for the ears than it is for the eyes.
Yeah.
It's not like Lord of the Rings on ice.
No. And I mean, never mind. Penis blender. Apparently, Culture Clash, they are still around. They did a collaboration with, this is why I don't know anything about them. They did a collaboration with the Oregon Shakespeare Fest last year. So I guess maybe if you live in the world of academia, you might be aware of that. Some of you ivory tower types will understand what that means. I don't. And by ivory, I mean Cheryl. I got in the biggest trouble ever with her because I called the Shakespeare Festival a Ren Fair. Well, see, I didn't know. It's guys walking around in pantaloons, isn't it? I mean, it's you know.
Yeah.
I just don't know. And then I felt bad because she brought me back a little keychain that was a Yorick skull at the end of it. And then I felt very small and awful. Hello, it's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. We're here with Mr. Big Jim Willick. He is in for Don Taylor, who will be returning, I mean, presumably, on Monday so forth. We got the Humor Me Comedy 101 coming up here in just a few. Before we do anything else, actually, I will do this. I'll just say that today's program and all of the ruminations contained within are brought to you by Squires Electric. You can find out more about them by going to squireselectric.com or calling 503-252-1609. That's 503-252-1609. They are licensed, bonded, and insured electrical installers, contractors, and supervisors. And if they send Ben to your house, he's a strapping young lad, kind of a looker,
yeah.
Has the stylish Battlestar Galactica tattoo on his forearm that he might, a forearm just really rippling with muscle, that he might show you, you know, like if you're just, you know, like if you play your cards right. I mean, I don't guarantee anything. I mean, it's not really my decision to make, but I'm just, you know.
See, when a guy's that strapping and he's smart and good with his hands, you really just, I personally just feel like less of a man.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you look at your marketable skills, I'm like, yeah, I got that. But I mean, you know, it's not like I went to, you know, this guy's got the ability to like to build like electrical things that
seriously
work and maintain them.
Like if you were on an island, you know. Well, all I can do is sit there and just make like Thunder the Barbarian references, you know, and it's like he's like building a boat out of a tree.
Yeah, that's gonna get real old somewhere around brunch the first day.
Hey, you know, here's an idea. You know what they ought to do? Okay, here's what somebody should do. You should be this somebody.
I can be this somebody.
Somebody should do this as like a piece of performance art, or then something that can be then put online as a sort of reality television program. There ought to just be. Like, and you would have to, I don't know how this would be a thing that wouldn't happen all the time, but when it happened, you'd capture it on film, and then if you had enough of it, you could put it on as a TV show. You'd set up the club accordingly. There ought to just be some show that consists of, like, you know, nights or events at comedy clubs where when a guy heckles you, like, somebody goes and, like, literally grabs him out of the audience and sticks him up on stage and just says, all right, make us laugh. You know, jag off. Be funny.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and that would be, I think, satisfying for viewers. Anybody who's ever sat next to a heckler, any comedian who's ever been heckled by a heckler. I mean, where, you know, it's like the guy heckles, like suddenly you just, you know, like there's a spotlight, like a boom out of the sky. And just, you know, like an alien nation spotlight on him. And then immediately it's like, I will step aside and you will amuse the people now.
Unfortunately, though, a lot of them, that's kind of what's hoping is going to happen. The whole reason why they're yelling out in the first place is because they want a piece of that spotlight. And if you give them the whole thing...
But then they'll suck, though, is the thing.
To everyone else but them.
Oh, that's
because
true.
Them getting up there just like, dude, you remember that time when I did that thing and it's so awesome? Like, actually, in hindsight, it was kind of humiliating and embarrassing, and you don't even have the kind of common sense to realize it. But again, that's okay, the mindset of the heckler.
No, that's a fair point. No, that's... No, that really is... Bigger Than Jesus, I talk about this. I do this bit toward the end where it's the seven types of guys you always see at a concert, and one of them is the they're here to see you, dude. And that is where the guy who fights his way all the way through the crowd, all the way through the, you know, security, gets his way out to the front of the stage, you know, and fights his way to the very, very front, right to the lip of the stage where the band is performing, just so he can turn around and like face the crowd and go, yeah. Because in his head, there's a little voice going, dude, they're here to see you. And that is like, that's totally, like, that is the heckler. So you're probably right. He's just oblivious. Well, like this guy. I love Roger Klein. Love Roger Klein and the Peacemakers. Huge fan of the band. See them every time they come to town. I never even told this story there because I felt so bad about it. But they were at Dante's, I guess, was it two Fridays ago? The 20th. Anyway, but they were at Dante's and went to see him, you know, with some friends of ours and just, you know, and listeners were there. And a couple of listeners who had never seen them before and were just going for the first time, including this listener who, this makes me feel freaking old. She's been listening to me since she was 14 or something because she lived in Utah and then happened to move here. Yeah. So she sort of inadvertently followed me. Anyway, and she's like, you know, she's like 30 or something now. But anyway, she's like, well, after hearing you talk about Roger Klein, like forever, never, 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 like I decided to finally go. And she ended up sitting, she went to the Roger Klein show at Dante's, ended up standing next to this one guy who anybody who was at the Roger Klein show at Dante's a couple weeks ago knows who I'm talking about. This guy, like, and it's not like it's the same crowd every time, but you know, you see people there that have gone to a lot of his shows. But it was this guy, nobody really knew, 7 feet tall, huge, big, like, Grossberger from Stir Crazy, huge. And with, like, a tank top that was, like, slit down the sides. He's all roomy and sweaty and greasy. And he's just got a cowboy hat, and every now and again he would shake it, and it was like a rainbird of sweat coming off. And he was just horrible and greasy and just covered with his own essence and just awful. But apparently, he was so drunk and just loving the show and thought that everybody was enjoying it the same way he was, and was like sidling up to her a lot through the show. And she said that like her shirt was like soaked with his like, and
it's so Nelly.
And she's just like, she's like, I don't mean to hurt your feelings. She's like, I can never go to another Roger Klein show. And now I have to like not listen to his music for a month so I can forget about that guy every time I hear a song, which sucks. So you're right. The heckler kind of is that guy.
Yeah.
Isn't aware that everyone else is hating him. Thinks that he is, you know, he is all that matters that night. Okay, okay, but here's a better idea. This is from our friend Seamus. He says, this is really why I am just like, I'm just an adjunct for the audience. Squires should hire Jim, Squires Electric, who you can find out more about at 503-252-1609 or facebook.com/Squires Electric to see examples of their service. They're licensed, bonded, and insured installers, electrical contractors, and supervisors. It says, Squires Electric, 503-252-1609, should hire Jim. He could entertain the customer while the electricians wire everything up. They could call it the Laughs Electricity Premium Service. The spelling of laughs is vital, of course. LAFFS.
Wow.
Laughs Electricity.
I dig that idea.
There you go. So, there you go. That's it.
Okay, because, I mean, Laughs Electricity. A lot of times, I'm sure when these guys go out to a gig, they're there to work, to put something together. And it's not like they're giving a tutorial to the person.
So what are you doing with that electrical tape?
Yeah.
So the homeowner wants to know, you're like, you know. So
I could give like a mock demonstration while they're kind of doing their thing. Because it's, I'm totally sure, it's distracting to them trying to do their thing, even though the person who's having the work done feels, again, kind of like an inadvertent heckler, that they're either helping or they're just curious about what they do on the daily.
And plus, if you're getting somebody who's like doing the work at your house, it's not that you don't trust them, but there is some weird, I think it's like an etiquette hosting thing where you feel like you got to hover in the immediate vicinity.
Yeah.
Can I help? Even though you know they don't want your help. And meanwhile, the electrician's going, no, I'm fine. Jackass, leave me alone. I'm trying to fix your light, you know, or whatever. So this laughs on electricity. There you go. That's good. They could also have this like doctor's offices. Like, you know, so you don't just sit there in the waiting room and just be nervous. There could be like a guy doing a little bit of stand-up in the waiting room, you know, as you're waiting for your colonoscopy or whatever. Just take your mind off things.
Yeah, it's so, like the Patch Adams circuit. Where
I'm surprised they haven't done that. Yeah.
Or like I would say dentist's office would be like really good because there's just that added stress of someone like, you know, working with like big scary tools in your mouth kind of thing. So I feel that, yeah, that this might be something, a venue worth looking into.
There's the dentist that I was going to downtown for the longest time. First of all, can I just tell you this about the first day? Because I went to, I guess I should, it's a Gentle Dental downtown.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Great place. And I should say, by the way, this, you know, it is like far and away the best dental experience I've ever had. That's a fact. But the first time I went there, and the doctor has subsequently retired, he ended up being a great guy. He was my dentist for like 2 or 3 years. I should say this is kind of funny. The first time I was there to get my dental work done, he'd been playing like racquetball or something. He'd been playing some sort of a sport, and he'd had one of those injuries where like the ball or something had whacked him in the eye, and so he had, I don't know what it's actually called, but it's like the bloody eyeball thing.
Ooh.
Where the eye's not bleeding, but it's just really blood red because it's been like smacked or punched with something.
Yeah, some kind of vessels ruptured.
I gotta tell you, that was the most unnerving. He's like, "Well, let me just take a look at your molar," and there's this huge bleeding eye, like 2 inches from my face. So, how's everything going? I'm just looking. It's like the eye of Sauron, just sort of like.
I see you haven't been flossing.
Exactly. Anyway, I don't even know what I was going to talk about here. Squires Electric.
Yes.
Bada bing. All right.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
All right, fantastic. We're here with Mr. Big Jim Willing. Hey, you offered to a fill. I'm going to have you fill for just a second while I. So gross. I have to blow my nose.
Oh.
I don't want to do it in here.
Okay.
Gross over here. So I'll just have you amuse the people for like 90 seconds or so.
Yeah, I can do that.
All right.
So, here's the thing. My name is Jim. I'm a dude. I like stuff. For the most part, when you're asked to fill time, that's only when all your brain kind of goes away. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, we'll be talking about a couple of news stories, one of which is regarding the Gmail hacking of the White House, as well as Tennessee making startling Netflix logon a crime. Sharing Netflix logon a crime. Heavy honeybee losses reported over the winter. And we got your grave watch, get your snuff watch. We got your news nuggets here for your enjoyment, no matter where you are, when you are, as this is basically available to you anytime whatsoever. This is like the beginning of the time machine. From this point on, this segment of me rambling can be sucked out and enjoyed, but probably just ignored. This is hopefully the part of the podcast where you get a phone call and you're like, "Ah, crap, I'm listening to this. This is really, really funny." And then you take a phone call and you come back, and then it's us talking again. And this whole part of me talking will just be, you know, extrapolated from the actual thing. I love how I'm like, I can fill. There's no problem at all. And then like the spotlight gets thrust on me. I'm just like, and I'm a frog in a box.
Sure, this has all gone really, really well.
Oh, it went great. No. Oh my God, the phone line should be lighting up with.
There's this whole thing where I was like, doesn't matter. Anyway, I was blowing my nose, and I had to throw it away. And then I went to flush the toilet, and then the toilet did that thing of look for a minute, like it was circling, but it looked like it wasn't going to flush.
Yeah.
And then it's like you got to stick around to see if it actually flushes, because otherwise, then it's like you're the guy who just left the toilet, like, you know, not working.
Yeah.
And so I did the second flush just now. That's not very interesting, I guess. I thought that was going to sound
funny. The
flush
is the loiterer, as the luring flush.
Well, and it would have just been, you know, like a tissue, but still, like, you don't want to be like, Emerson was just in here. Oh, and the toilet is, you know, and then like immediately they make all sorts of associations. If it had worked as a sight gag, if this was like some sort of a television broadcast, what would have been really fantastic is if, like, I'd said, "Can you just fill for a second and you talk?" And then like out the window in the background, you just see me getting in my car and just driving off. just tight, like all small in the background, just walking into my car and then just sort of gone.
And then like the slow realization look of horror and glazed over, and then my voice cracks.
I think actually ideally you wouldn't even seen it though. Like you would be staring ahead into into the microphone, but in the background the audience just sees me just getting into my vehicle and just driving off.
Yeah, I just sort of throw out a couple of temporary tidbits. We'll be back here in just a quick second, and you know, as the slow the clock ticks. Funny that you should mention about the toilet. I had a realization also that being a large guy, people assume that you are clumsy and or unkempt for the most part. So any place that has like a public bathroom, I've walked in a couple of times, and I leave places cleaner than I find them. Mostly because of the fact that if I come in...
Inverting the stereotype.
Exactly. If I come in and it's filthy in there, I almost feel the compulsion to clean up so that if I were just to sort of go in there, grab a piece of paper, and then leave, the next person in there is just like, oh, this fat guy came in, he peed on the ceiling and on the floor and some kind of weird, like, half-eaten food, like, over... who eats in the bathroom anyway? And then I would have this whole neurosis thing going, so I feel the need to kind of clean up. And I'm sure that skinny people just sort of go in there, leave a mess as large as they want, knowing... And that as they leave, they'll be like, oh, this guy's...
You know. Well, it's like, you know, skinny people can just eat anything with impunity out of the fridge or just store anything in there, you know, because people will automatically go, well, that can't possibly be his. Yeah. You know, it's like, yeah, I had a roommate. It was like, it was a thing where it was like, I'm a skinny guy, and he was a big guy. But it's like, people would, like, if I left food or something up, people would constantly go like, Curtis, is yours? And he's, no, it's not my... Shut up. And they would just automatically assume, or like if anything, like fast food was sitting around, yeah, or just like, what's just like a big bucket of like, you know, just a big bucket of congealed lard. Like they would just assume like, is this your lard? Fat guy?
Is this your container of cake frosting with the finger marks all over it? No, it's not. I have the carrots.
Sure, let's see. We have breaking news here. Let's do this. We're going to throw it to you. Let's start with the snuff watch because you've got half of it. But yes. I've got the other breaking half. Without further ado, let's just...
And now, from the news desk, this is John Willing.
Hey, well done.
Thank you.
All right.
Ah, yeah, so, snuff watch.
All right, here's your snuff watch for Friday on the Rick Emerson radio program. We've got a single, now an ad hoc double snuff watch. The first half of that here is Jim Willig.
Assisted suicide advocate and cardigan enthusiast Jack Kevorkian has died at a Detroit area hospital at the age of 83. His attorney, Mayor Magroff, said that it appears that Kevorkian suffered a pulmonary thrombosis when a blood clot from his leg broke free and lodged in his heart. It was peaceful. He didn't feel anything, Magroff told the Detroit Free Press, adding that there were no artificial attempts to keep Kevorkian alive and no plans for a memorial. It's kind of sad.
Because he was, I mean, I think he didn't have a wife. He had no, like, I don't think he had, like, any family or whatever. He was just sort of, you know, he was just kind of this lone guy out there with this lone guy driving around just, you know.
In a van.
With a van with a bunch of tanks full of carbon monoxide just looking for business. So, here's the thing about Dr. Kevorkian is so weird because I think we have he's such a weird character in American life. Because I think he's in favor of and was administering an act and attempting to legalize an act that I think probably most of us agree with on some level. Oregon is a right to die state, and so I don't think anybody has a problem with that, but it was like, for some reason, even though we know it's wrong, we just couldn't help finding him creepy. And it's just so bad to say, because he's only creepy because he's going to people's houses and gassing them, which wouldn't have been necessary if, like, it wasn't illegal.
Well, I think that, and I hate to sort of bring aesthetics into this, but like you said, I mean, if you put Kevorkian in a lineup, first of all, the name sounds like a technique one uses to put somebody to sleep.
It sounds like he's the guy who welcomes you to Dachau.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or possibly, the boat farer on the River Styx.
Totally.
Like, you know, he's just kind of filling time here. But, I mean, if you put him in a lineup, a bunch of other people, and said, okay, one of the guys here assists with, you'd be able to pick him out almost every time.
No, he looks like a death's head.
Yeah. But if you had just kind of like a bland, boring everyman that kind of disappears into the background.
Bill Pullman.
Yeah. I think he would be more of not too pretty, not too hideous, just a kind of like a khaki human being. That would be a better advocate for the cause. because of the fact that, you know, it doesn't bring any added attention to it. Like you said, when you have a guy that looks like the Grim Specter of Death working as the Grim Specter of Death, it just does nothing but detract from the overall cause.
It's too much spectering of death.
Absolutely.
Really. Well, it's like, when it's, you know, it's like the weed legalization guys. It's like they always try to get, you know, it's always just some jackass. It's like in a Dr. Seuss hat on a unicycle. You know, it's like on Outlook Portland, we interviewed the guy who's the president of the, he heads the Oregon chapter of Normal, marijuana legalization guys, and they're smart enough at this point to know that, like, they can't have some guy who's like a stoner, and he's just like absolutely, like, totally full on screamingly, like, clean cut, yeah, and Boy Scoutish, because it's like they have to have that. And you're right, that, and plus the other thing about Kevorkian is, like, he just didn't, for good or bad, you could tell that he just didn't, like, he didn't feel like it had to be justified. Like, to him, it was, like, so self-evident.
Yeah.
He's like, this is the right thing to do, and so I'm going to do it, and you can follow me with the camera if you want to, or put me in jail if you feel like I have to, but, like, in the meantime, like, I got stuff to do, but, you know, bye. Yeah. And he just didn't, he had no concern for, like, the media gloss of the presentation. He was like, I'm a doctor, I got stuff to do, you know, bye. Yeah.
And almost, I think, that kind of, you know, in a weird way, kind of endeared me to it, because what he had to do, or what he felt was required to do, this peaceful way of giving people a way to kind of die with dignity, isn't a pretty thing to do. It is an ugly job by its very nature. You're bringing somebody to the very end. He's going to make it as you know, peaceful for the person of interest, but ultimately knows that it's going to end as gritty as it does.
Yeah.
It doesn't get any grittier than this, than the end of a human's life. So because of which, yeah, there doesn't have to be a dressing up of it. There just has to be making it as peaceful for someone for as long as possible. But ultimately, you know,
well, and also that didn't help. That, and we've said, several people have noted that they you know, that they called him Dr. Death, which didn't help.
No,
and that was like that he couldn't get rid of that label. You know, but yeah, if it is one of those things. I mean, it's, you know, whatever. And I'm not like some activist, you know, thing or whatever. But it's the thing that, you know, that was considered controversial and scandalous, and he was put in prison, and he was, you know, and it was such a huge, you know, polarization that went on for something that within just a few years we all kind of went, yeah, well, I guess it's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that I'm oversimplifying it, but I mean, like, as a society, we've come so far in terms of assisted suicide and, you know, all of that stuff, that it's like, I think that was like the last, one of the last gasps of, like, of misguided moral outrage against it before we all just acknowledged that, like, it just seemed yeah, right. It was the right thing to do.
I always kind of likened it to, and this is going to sound kind of weird, but pets, you know, when you keep your pet alive through drugs and through needless operations, you're not doing it for the pet's benefit. You're doing it for your benefit.
Totally.
You're trying to keep them alive. Now, granted, if somebody has a severe mental illness and isn't aware of the world around them, then I feel that there isn't as black and white an issue there. But if the person is in a constant state of pain and they just want to be let go, then absolutely, then they have the right to call the shots, literally.
Well, seriously, it's like, I mean, that's, you know, that's a thing that just seems so obvious, I think, to a lot of us, that's the response. That is, I think, why the response of people like ourselves to people who are opposed to assisted suicide, it's not even like I get angry. It's like I get sort of stupefied, because I just can't conceive. Like, it seems so obvious to me that, like, you know, it's up to me, you know, what I'm doing at any given moment. Even if that thing is like strapping on a carbon monoxide mask, like, what do you care? So there's the first half of that. The second half of the Snuffwatch is I'm reading this from Ken Tucker at Entertainment Weekly. James Arness. And he's described as a great sequoia tree in the forest of TV Western heroes. Has died. He was 88. Arness is immortal in TV history as Marshal Matt Dillon on TV's Gunsmoke.
Oh, wow.
The longest running network drama in television history with 635 episodes. Arness, a 6'7" quiet man who gave an air of serene authority to Matt Dillon. Let's see. See now on cable reruns. Tucker says Gunsmoke looks like an old-fashioned Western filled with shootouts and swinging door saloons. And it also had Dennis Weaver. He was part of the cast as well. He was Chester. And it had Burt Reynolds on in the latter part of the show's run as a Quint something or other. But you know, and I'm not like a huge Gunsmoke guy. Like that's Gunsmoke is a thing that I watched a little bit when I was a kid, like in the advent of like Nick at Night.
Yeah.
Now Nick at Night is sort of gone, right? TV Land is Nick at Night.
Yeah.
Okay, so boy, I'm just dating myself with that. But there was Nickelodeon, which they then decided that kids weren't awake at night, so they were going to turn it into an adult channel at night, a parents' channel. That became Nick at Night, which then became TV Land. But Nick at Night would run all of these like old reruns of stuff. And Gunsmoke, again, the guy, you could watch Gunsmoke literally every single day without fail, and it would be 2 years before you'd see an episode again. I mean, it was just awesome. I mean, the show just ran like forever and ever and ever. And he was, I mean, you know, he's one of those guys that largely because there was such a unanimity of television choice because there were only a handful of channels and a handful of shows. I mean, he just like just towered over everybody, you know, in the television landscape, literally and figuratively, because he was just such a... he was just such a massive figure on a show that became, by dint of being on forever, such a part of the American lexicon. So there you go.
I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing when someone has, you know, obviously achieved that level of notoriety and then is kind of like retired, faded in the background, and then you find out they died and you're just like, oh, I thought they'd been dead for years.
Totally. He's still alive?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that is one of those things where it's like, and it happens to TV shows themselves.
Yeah.
X-Files is still on, you know, and it's, you know, but, you know, it's one of those things that is just an unavoidable risk of playing a character like that.
Yeah.
Let's see. Thomas Gill says, Nick at Night is still on Late Night. By the way, he says DeForest Kelly, Dr. McCoy, was on Gunsmoke. Also, James Doohan and finally Leonard Nimoy, who played an Indian. Awesome. We'll go on that. There's your double snuff watch. Genius. Because we teased it, we'll do the Grave Watch here, and then we'll do Humor Me Comedy 101. Let's see. Don't forget, after this program is done today, we'll have a brief musical interlude.
Yeah, I like them both.
Followed by an encore of Legion of News and this very fine radio program. This is your Grave Watch for Friday.
I'm digging up bones. I'm digging up bones. Zooming things that's better left alone. I'm resurrecting memories of love that's dead and gone. Yet tonight I'm sitting alone, digging up bones.
All right, here's your Grave Watch for Friday. Here's Big Jim Willig.
Hamilton, New Jersey. Woman is injured in Hamilton graveyard by falling tombstone during, quote, extracurricular activities. A woman who may have been engaging in flagrante delicto in a township cemetery Tuesday evening was injured when a tombstone fell on her leg. A 39-year-old woman was not badly hurt, and the administration of the Israel Cemetery declined to press charges, according to police. The woman was with a male friend in the graveyard off Cedar Lane just after 7 p.m., visiting the grave of a relative, when the two engaged in some extracurricular activities. One of the grave markers rolled onto the woman's leg, Captain James Stevens said of the local police force.
How is it? I mean, there's so many questions here that have not been...
The brain kind of almost shuts down.
I mean, we can all agree that cemetery sex is hot.
Clearly.
But I mean, come on.
Bucket list, check.
But visiting a relative is the first question mark there. Like, what relative is it? They were just like so happy that Aunt Gladys was dead. That, like, you know, that was the last thing they, you know, well, how should we celebrate? Well, but then also, like, the idea of the tombstone or the headstone or whatever it is rolling onto her,
marker,
which is like shades of Creepshow. I mean, like, I don't even know how that would, I mean, that's heavy. It's because, you know, they call it a stone because it's made of, you know, stone.
Yeah.
How would it roll? Like, unless there was like somebody was leaning against it, or like that was where the harness was hooked up.
Yeah, because it's one of those things where it wasn't like a giant boulder, you know, precariously positioned on top of a small stick. This was something that, you know, usually made of granite, And then to go to a hospital or have to have, like, you know, medical personnel, you know, called to the area.
Well, like, I wonder if she was, like, pinned underneath it or something. Like, you have to bring somebody here for this or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, and then you're wondering, like, what was the sexual positioning or, you know.
Is her name? Did they give her name?
I don't believe so.
See, that means I can't Google her face.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Someone did, luckily.
Wang.
But yeah, but seriously, to be at the grave of a family member, so I'm just going to go ahead and speculate that the family member in question was one that didn't hold a positive favor, and as a way to sort of, like, you know, rub it in their face just one last time, like, you know, let's do it right here.
Somebody has typed out what they believe that the conversation might have been. Yeah, you cheating bastard. Watch the neighbor plow me right above you. .. my leg.
What's the word? Yeah. What are you going to do about it? You couldn't do anything in life. Now you're like,
Yeah. That's so then Nathan Grantham just pulls the tombstone right down on you.
Yeah, I think that this is a birth of some kind of an odd urban legend.
It's like, you know, and first of all, can we all just agree, like, without even seeing her, that the chick is probably hot? I mean...
For my purposes.
Bonked in a cemetery? Hot. Yeah. That's the kind of girl who does that.
You know, and even if she's like kind of middle of the road, kind of like, she's kind of pretty.
No, that's like a guy being able to play the guitar really well. Yeah. You know, it's suddenly, the aura suddenly.
It forgives a lot of the aesthetics.
Yes, it's like being photographed in a good light.
Yeah.
All right, there you go. There's your grave watch for, and then any number of people are weighing in now about sex in cemeteries. Thank you.
I'm digging up bones. I'm digging up bones. Things that's better left alone. I'm resurrecting memories of love that's dead and gone. Yet tonight I'm sitting alone, digging up bones.
Excellent. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. Don't forget, coming up after a brief musical interlude today, we will have an encore of this very fine radio program and an encore of today's Legion of News as well. I was going to say something about join us next week, but it's completely gone. Why you might want to do that, apart from our own radiant wit. This coming Sunday, don't forget to watch Outlook Portland. This coming Sunday, Cable Channel 3, Northwest 32 TV. You can also find out more about it at outlookportland.com. We're going to be joined by Mr. Stephen Cassell, and he's the founder of Cassell Communications, and he's also on the board of the Q Center here in Portland. And he's going to talk about it really is a fascinating conversation with this guy, Stephen Cassell. You can watch him in this Sunday's Outlook Portland. He works at the Cassell Communications, which is a public relations firm, but he's just a fascinating discussion about marketing and about how he got into marketing as a kid. And he's one of the only people I've ever done that literally in real life had like a lemonade stand that apparently did like thriving, flourishing business where he was like the Sam Walton, and he just, you know, completely like destroyed all of his competition and then consolidated their holdings at like five or something.
Wow.
He's just great. He's the most fascinating guy. But he runs a public relations firm here now, and he's also the board of the Q Center, and he's the guy who put together the Hands Across the Hawthorne thing that happened last week.
Yeah.
After the two guys got beaten down by the Esplanade. He's just a great guy, and he talks about the Q Center and about the Q Patrol, which is the thing that they're now doing it from now to the end of the year to try to keep people safe and keep, you know, like other jagoffs from just taking out their issues on, like, you know, like some hapless guys who are holding hands. So it's a wide ranging but fascinating conversation that is this coming Sunday, Outlook Portland, Mr. Stephen Cassell. Without further ado, though, will you please give your attention to the man on the mic? It's Mr. Big Jim Willig, who is here filling in for Don Taylor. This is another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101.
Thank you very much, Mr. Emerson. Now, the most popular humor is that which appeals to all ages. You know, it's got to be safe for the kids, while at the same time lobbing enough mature, i.e. flatulent/body part jokes, over their fuzzy little heads to keep the adults laughing right along. And it should have it all. You know, a huge stage, relationship material, heroes, villains, guest stars, animals, a chef, musical numbers, a cast of thousands, and of course, two old guys sitting in the rafters talking trash.
Oh, what's wrong with you?
It's either this show or indigestion. I hope it's indigestion.
Why?
It'll get better in a little while.
Ah, hell, you know what I'm getting at. Just play the music.
It's time to play the music. It's time to light the light. It's time to meet the Muppets on the Muppet Show tonight.
If you were a star in the Hollywood during the 70s and 80s and you wanted a barometer to kind of gauge your success, you only needed to appear on two shows, Johnny Carson and The Muppet Show.
Please, sir. My name is Kermit the Frog, and we read your ad, and, well, we've come to be rich and famous.
Miss Tracy, prepare the standard rich and famous contract for Kermit the Frog and Company.
Jim Henson and Frank Oz are revered as gods in the land of imagination, with over 120 guest stars in their heyday alone, featuring everybody from Alice Cooper to Jim Nabors, Sandy Duncan, and Raquel Welch. The Muppet Show was, is, and always will be a reason to come together, regardless of age. If you even have a small sliver of a heart, then there's going to be a huge, multicolored, felt-wrapped place for Kermit and the rest of the gang. All right, then, we'll get things started with the most sensational, inspirational, celebrational, Muppetational. And this is why we call it The Rick Emerson Show, with tonight's special guest, me, of course. Your thoughts on the immortal Muppet Show.
I had no idea you were going to do the Muppet Show until I saw, you know, the thing that you sent the clips to my inbox. And I was so happy that you picked this, because I was actually just thinking about the Muppet Show. There's the trailer that's going around, you know, the Green with Envy or whatever. But I have at home, I have the complete season three collection, the DVD set for the Muppet Show. And every now and again, I don't power load it. Every now and again, I'll take it out and I'll put one in and I'll watch an episode or two.
Yeah.
Just I'm trying to sort of make it last, because I think they're all out on DVD, but I want to sort of, you know, and I haven't seen them for so long that it is like watching it from scratch. So I'm trying to sort of extend that as long as possible. But I was watching some of the stuff of that season three, which is, by the way, season three is great, because that is the season where Alice Cooper was a guest.
Yes.
Also, the guy, you make me feel like dancing, Leo Sayer.
Yeah.
Leo Sayer. Also, I think Henry Winkler was on that season, and it was just, I mean, I don't even know where to start with it. You're right. I mean, where to start with the Muppet Show, except to say that, I mean, I'm not going to say it hasn't dated. You can tell when it was made, I think, only because of the guest stars, and not even that, but the way the guest stars kind of look. Like, I mean, Leo Sayer is out there with big bell bottoms. Sure, it's the 70s. That notwithstanding, if you sort of overlook, you know, apart from the actual like costuming of some of the human guest stars, that show has not dated an iota. I mean, not a molecule of that seems dated or old or out of style, because the brilliance, I mean, one of the many, 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 many pieces of brilliance of that show, one of the master strokes, though, was the idea to make it a vaudeville show, effectively.
Yeah.
And a throwback variety-style vaudeville show from 50 years before the 70s. It was already old. It was like it was dated when it went on the air, which is what makes it perfect and timeless. I mean, The Muppet Show is really, it is one of those things that I would hold up as an almost flawless piece of entertainment in total.
Absolutely. I mean, it's self-deprecating, you know, with Statler and Waldorf. Another masterful stroke would be the fact that it was, in essence, it was children's programming, because it's a bunch of puppets and, you know, a lot of humor that is kind of geared towards children, but with, at the same time, adult guest stars
right
on it. So, in essence, what they're doing is they're taking all these children of the 70s and the 80s, you know, and it's safe for any age. So that's basically guaranteeing that there will be an audience 20, 30,
right,
40 years down the road, because they got in on the ground floor with so many fans.
Now, the thing about the Muppet Show as well, going back to the business of it being like vaudeville, is that it wasn't just that it was a vaudeville show, it wasn't just a variety show. I mean, they did two other things that were great. One is they let you see the behind the scenes of in the dressing room and backstage and in the wings, and also, it was, when you said self-deprecating, it's such an endearing show, because it's not just a vaudeville theater or a variety show troupe. It's a kind of threadbare, like, low-budget variety show where they're just doing the best they can, you know, with the stuff they've got. And it's, you know, and they're you know, and it's kind of this ragtag, scrappy band of misfits in this sort of like broken down kind of aging theater, putting on the best show that is possible with the materials they have. And that makes it instantly like a thing you root for.
Yeah.
You know, because they're just, and you know, and you've got Kermit, who is so great as the, And it's very telling, the genius of, you know, Frank Oz and Jim Henson and all of those guys, and I mean, and probably dozens of others whose names we don't know because, you know, because they were behind it, because they're crouching down holding a piece of felt. I mean, you just don't ever see them. Jim Henson, Frank Oz, you know, because they did other, because Jim Henson was the guy and because Oz did so many other things, we sort of know those guys. But, you know, all of them, all of the guys who worked, you know, for and with and around Henson, you know, it's a testament to how brilliant they are. That just, like, even without even thinking about it, just now, I do what everybody does. I'm just referring to Kermit as a, like, he's like an actual person.
Yeah.
Not, you know, like Jim Henson as Kermit. I'm like, because Kermit is his own, it's his own stand, he's his own standalone entity. I mean, he is his own person because he's a fully realized and formed character and personality. Yeah. And that he is in the center of this maelstrom just trying to keep things working. Just trying to keep things running, you know, and just a man just surrounded by and very nearly but never quite overwhelmed by chaos where there's just like explosions and cannons. And I mean, that is the other great thing about the Muppet Show that I think maybe is people learn, they see it, but they don't quite know how to execute it with the same perfection, is that barely controlled chaos.
Yeah.
Because you would just have things happening out of nowhere, out of the blue, you know, things falling out of the ceiling and things blowing up and things being shot into the audience and, you know, things being, you know, squirted with water and things catching on fire and things, you know, chickens suddenly, like, you know, appearing backstage being chased by Alice Cooper or whatever, you know, and it was just, it was anarchy, but just very carefully, tightly controlled sense of anarchy that is, I think, no one has replicated since then.
Absolutely not. And, yeah, it made you also feel like you were talking about the sense of controlled chaos. The way that the show was set up, you always felt like they were one show away from cancellation.
Totally.
So that even gave you another reason to kind of want to tune in, you know, the following week. You know, and of course, you have Sesame Street being like the kind of like the I don't know if it's like a spinoff or, you know, because it kind of became its
I think
own.
It predated... Sesame Street, I think, predates The Muppet Show, because I think The Muppets themselves, they had been on, like, some of the early Tonight shows and some of the, like, in the early, you can go back and see these great, you know, early appearances of Henson and some of the Muppet creatures on, like, you know, like the Jack Parr show, kind of, you know, that kind of stuff.
Black and white TV.
Yeah, and I think... I want to say on SNL, but I don't know if it was at SNL or if I'm thinking of like SCTV or something like that. But they, you know, they did a lot of those shows. Then I think Sesame Street came into existence as like an offshoot that became really successful. And then they kind of got their marquee show, which was The Muppet Show, which was that was sort of their star time there. And it's, you know, and then, you know, and then all of the other stuff, you know, the Fraggle Rock and the Dark Crystal and Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas and all of those sorts of things that came out of Henson's, you know, laboratory.
And to take such a risk with primetime Sunday night television, if memory serves, I remember so distinctly as a kid, glued to the TV, I think it was the Muppet Show, either before or after the Dukes of Hazzard.
Right.
So I mean, that was like you must watch television for a Sunday night, and it was like it was always nostalgic because it was like the last gasp of the weekend before you had to go back to school or you had to go back to work or whatever, was the Muppet Show. So you had that, you got sent back off into like the real world with your friends, and then of course you got like the Great Muppet Caper, where I mean it was like multi-million-dollar budget, and. It's you know, you're paying $7 to watch a puppet show basically on the big screen, and you couldn't wait for it, you know. And then of course you have certain aspects of it that you know, to this day, I mean, while I was writing this, I was kind of getting choked up.
Oh yeah, no, it's,
you know, because you got like the Rainbow Connection. I don't know what it is about that song, but it just reaches into you and kind of reminds you that there is still very much alive a little kid and always will be.
I think for a lot of people of our generation, you know, I think if you were going to find like commonalities or shared experiences for our generation in terms of the world of pop culture and entertainment, I mean, one of those has got to be like Jim Henson dying. I mean, which was which just like wrecked like everybody I knew. I mean, everybody. And I mean, to this day, I mean, you talk about it and it's like people, like grown men will just, I mean, I will sit, it's, you know, I'll absolutely just, you know, it'll just totally, if you're in the, if you are in in either the right or wrong frame of mind, depending on how you look at it. I mean, that is a thing that can, that even now you mention it to people and it's like they'll just tear up.
Yeah.
You know, it was sort of like Mr. Rogers dying. It was the same thing where it was like, it was just like a pillar of your life had just been knocked out from underneath you in a way that you don't feel about like the guy who voiced Mickey Mouse or whatever. Like you just don't, there's just, because the thing about the Muppets is, and this came from Henson himself and obviously the people around him, is there was this humanity to the Muppets. There's, in a way, it's sort of the same thing that there is with the Warner Brothers cartoon characters as opposed to Disney. You know, nobody looks at, like, Mickey Mouse or Goofy or whatever and goes, they really speak to me as a, you know, but if you look at, like, Bugs Bunny or Daffy Duck, you know, you feel like they are, you almost feel like they're close to real people, that they mirror real human behavior and emotions to some degree, exaggerated, of course. But the Muppets had that, they had a really warm humanity to them. I saw there's an interview that's with that Jim Henson did with 60 Minutes, and they reran it after he died. And he was just, he was so clearly just like a good guy. I mean, just a decent guy. And at one point, and he was so reluctant to admit to having any power or wealth. They said, you know, like, are you worth $10 million? And he said, oh, probably not. And they said, are you worth, and this is the guy who, like, you know, he is the Muppet guy. And they said, are you worth $1 million? And he said, well, probably, but I wouldn't swear to that or anything. And it was like, he was so, didn't want to want that focused on it. Didn't, you got the sense it didn't even matter to him, except to the extent that it allowed him to do the stuff he wanted to do with his creatures. Lara had never seen, she had never seen Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas, and Cheryl actually gave that to me last December for Christmas, and I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I'm not too savvy. I don't think.
Okay, it was a. Dude, I know what I'm getting you for Christmas. I'm not even going to wait. Christmas in July.
Sweet.
It was a made-for-TV special that Henson and his family did. It was actually based on a book, I think, from the early 70s. But it was a made-for-TV special that Henson and his crew did. And it was all puppets and everything. There weren't any of the regular Muppet characters. Although in the original airing, it was a special that was sort of introduced by Kermit, who said, and now we have a you know thing for you tonight called Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas. But it was a totally original cast of characters. But it's this story of Emmett Otter and his mom, and who are these the whole thing is sort of a play on like hard scrabble life in like Appalachia, you know, the sort of like, you know, the sort of very 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 poor rural communities in America, but it's depicted with, you know, with these sort of anthropomorphized animals. And anyway, but it's the story of Emmett, and it's the story of Emmett and his mother, each of whom want to get the other something for Christmas, but they don't have the money. And it's like, you know, it's a whole kind of a gift to the major, I think. And it's, anyway, so I put, and Lara had never seen it. And I was like, you know, j'accuse, you know, you. And there's like, a Cheryl again, I'm like, look, she got me Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas. And I was like, what's that? And I'm like, sit down now, woman. And we put it on, and it was like, I mean, I get like three, it's like watching the Iron Giant. It's like I get 3 minutes into it, and I'm just blubbering like a child. And by the end, of course, we're both doing it.
Yeah.
But there is something about the Muppets that just, it just hits that weak spot for you, and I mean, in the best way possible. I mean, this sounds so corny, but I mean, we all know it's true, that watching the Muppets and having that reaction, it does, like, it does remind you that you are, that you do have humanity, and that you can care about things that even, you know, that you should be jaded beyond, that as an adult, you should not get worked up about it. You shouldn't have any sort of emotional investment in, or so we think. Years ago on this show, this one of our producers, one of the first producers to really sort of resonate with the show and to be a big part of the show was this woman named Christina Carlson. And Christina at one point got married. She was married, but she moved with her husband to Bend, and she left the show and to move to Bend. And that was a change with which I dealt really, really poorly at the time, because I was really, really angry at her for leaving. And so I was a real jerk, like, for weeks before she left. I was just kind of a big dick. And, you know, and then she and I eventually, you know, sort of made up and whatever. But on her final show before she left, we played, I think, in March as one of our best ofs when I was in New York. And the final show before she left, the final thing we played was the Saying Goodbye song for the Muppets Take Manhattan. Which, I mean, you listen back to it, and I was listening, I hadn't heard that show since it aired, since like 10 years ago. And it was like, and I think by the end of the song, I think like all of us on the show were crying. I mean, it just be, and especially the thing I can't even think about, I mean, even now, is like, you know, I'm sitting here just on like a Friday afternoon in Portland. I am nearly 40 years of age, And it's like it very nearly makes me tear up now to think about, you know, because that was the song they performed at Henson's funeral.
Yeah.
And it's like that just, I mean, you know, there is some intangible thing there that is, you can't quantify, but that the Muppets were made of some kind of just magic, some sort of fairy dust gold in the Muppets and in their comedy. And I'm not trying to be a big buzzkill about it and make everybody all, you know, just trying to be a big depresso guy. It's because it's there in the humor too. That there's like they're funny in a way that other things just aren't. I mean, there's just something that is, and none of which would be as impressive, but they're just felt. I mean, it's just they're basically blankets with ping pong balls on them, and yet. And yet they are just, you know, you are reacting to them and laughing at them as though they are some of the funniest human beings, you know, with facial expressions. And with the fact that Kermit can do these sort of weird, that thing where he like scrunches up his upper lip when he's sort of unhappy about something.
Yeah.
And you just, you know, and it seems perfectly natural. It seems exactly like a facial expression that person would make.
Yeah.
And it's, you know.
I just, I think that's, you know, a lot of it also comes from the fact that from watching the Muppets, whenever, you know, a actual human being kind of walks in, they're the ones sticking out like the sore thumb. Like, you know, obviously they're the special guest, but it's just like, yeah, you're kind of not supposed to be there.
Right.
And, you know, there's part of you that's kind of saying that, like, you know, that's, you know, it's not like you don't want them to be there, but, and then you sort of see their interaction with the Muppets. And I always was amazed by the fact that every guest star that comes on there always seemed kind of very at ease with the Muppets around them. And it's because of that fact. You know, I mean, you don't see it from the standpoint of like, okay, you're seeing them from the waist up. And like, you know, if you looked at it from the other side, you're seeing like hundreds of people kind of like wandering around like this under scaffolding kind of like, you know.
Raquel Welch talked about that, about the fact that you like, she's like, you know, Jim Henson is like right below me, below camera level. Operating all the effort. She's like, but I never once talked to Jim Henson. She's like, you never talked to him when you were on set.
Yeah.
Just because you found yourself naturally speaking to Kermit because your mind accepted him as a person.
Yeah.
That's how complete the illusion was and how much they embodied, you know, those characters. I mean, it was really, and I look back when I was a kid, and as with, you know, a few other things, God forbid, hee-haw being one of them. Very few things in my family that we could all agree on in terms of television. There were not a lot of shows that we could all watch at the same time and get along. You know, we couldn't watch All in the Family because my parents would end up fighting about something with my sister or with somebody else who was there. And it's like a lot of the stuff my parents watched they didn't think was appropriate for kids. My parents didn't want to watch cartoons. We could all watch The Muppet Show. And I look back at that now and I'm also glad that I watched The Muppet Show because, as strange as this may seem, it introduced me to a lot of music that I would not have heard. Because when you think about it, they had everything from Leo Sayer to Alice Cooper to having opera, to have classical performances, to having bluegrass, to having country songs. You'd see Mel Tillis on there, and I mean, that's where were you going to get that as a kid? You were going to get this huge cross cultural spectrum,
absolutely.
You know, of, I mean, it was just it's like the thing I always go back to this thing of when Stevie Wonder was on Sesame Street, he's playing. Superstition, you know, with his band, and he's, you know, and this segment, this piece of Sesame Street has been discussed and analyzed a lot over the years. But I've seen different commentators talk about it, where you, and this is in the 70s, you see Stevie Wonder there, and he's got this great, and you know, he's got the multiracial band where he's got, you know, it's a very, very, like, you know, it's a lineup, it's, you know, it's not just a bunch of white guys, it's not just a bunch of black guys, it is the full, you know, it's a spectrum.
Yeah.
And he's playing the song, which is just like, and I mean, he's like selling it. I mean, he's on Sesame Street. He could phone it in. He could lip sync. He could do whatever. But it's like he's like they're delivering it. Like they're bringing it. And then the camera and Sesame Street is, of course, something that I never realized until I was an adult and went to New York, which was sort of poignant or bittersweet. I never realized until I went to New York City that Sesame Street takes place in a tenement, which is sort of weird and I guess sort of beautiful in its own way. But the camera points up to like this second floor apartment, this second floor room, and there's a railing like a there's the fire escape, and there's this like little boy with the kind of long hair, and he's whatever. And there's a little boy out there on it, and he's like 7 years old, and it's like he is just losing his mind. It's like he's just like he's like whipping his head around, and his hair is flying, and he's like just he's like kind of throwing his body back and forth to the music, and it's, you know, and it like in that instant, it's like, you know, they sort of go underneath the radar or past. whatever societal barricades or shields eventually get put there by your parents or by the media or by other people, about how you're supposed to view things or what sort of cultures, what sort of cultures can mix and what sort of cultures can't. And like it cut through all of that with just, he just heard it and saw it and just responded to it in this very real way, in a way that like nothing can prevent. Yeah. And it was, the Muppet Show was... It was like that, where I, because they presented it to me in the right way, I just accepted all of these forms of music week in and week out, without thinking. And I just accepted them equally, which is, a thing that is in short supply these days, I think.
I mean, you can sit and speculate and pontificate on any manner of things. You can draw anything you want to or from the Muppets, And something that I don't have any issue with is... the fact that the Muppets, they weren't people, in the traditional sense, but they were all different colors, different shapes, different sizes, and their guests were also, of all different, nationalities. So there was no racism, there was no segregation, it was a perfect world.
I had never thought about that, actually, until I was, and I'm embarrassed to admit, I had never thought about this until... it might have been Lara, actually, who made this point to me. And I felt silly then because, because I come, I'm just a white guy in a white town growing up. And what the hell do I know about anything? But she pointed out, years later, she's like, imagine if, imagine that you are, you are growing up a minority. You are growing up in the inner city. You are growing up feeling marginalized for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And you hear that song, It's Not Easy Being Green. She's like, of course you're just some white kid. Like, what do you know?
Yeah.
But, if you insert any other, descriptor into that and, like, imagine what a message that might have been, a message you might not have heard a lot.
And he even makes reference to it in the song. He's like, it would be different being yellow or white or,
right.
brown or anything like that.
Which they could get away with because they're puppets.
Yeah.
And because and that's a thing that I think if they had tried to do that with just live actors, I think people would have rejected it, or it would have been divisive, or you would have had like jagoffs like my dad who were, well, that's a bunch of liberal nonsense or whatever. But because it's puppets, they can get away with stuff. Somebody, our friend Jesus in the OC says, I once knew a chick who said she didn't like the Muppets or, quote, get the Muppets. I said, bye then, have a nice life. So, well done. Let's see. Our friend Seamus says, he says, Mr. Rogers and the Muppets are a lot like your dog, the one thing in life that accepts you and offers pure kindness and sincerity and affection, even if the world around you, even if the world around you is full of criticism and anger and instability, he said, basically, that every hour you're with the Muppets or Mr. Rogers is an hour that you're not dealing with just chaos and just, unpleasantness and whatever, so.
Absolutely.
Well, all right, then. If I hugged people, we'd hug right now.
I think so, too.
And then I'd hug all the members of the audience. It's not going to happen in actuality or in point of fact, but...
I'll take a virtual hug from Rick Emerson.
There you go. Excellent. Right? There we go. And we're done. And I cupped one of your bucks as well. Strongly recommended by me and, like, by everybody, though, if you haven't seen it or, God forbid, or haven't seen it in a long time... go rent or buy even just that that DVD set of any of the seasons that are out now.
Absolutely,
I have the season 3 one. Man, it's just gold. It is just so. And the thing is, you will be, if you're like anything like me, you will be stunned at how funny it still is.
Yeah.
And that's not like I'm viewing everything through the prism of nostalgia. A lot of stuff I watched growing up is crap. It's terrible, and it just doesn't hold up. It was amazing how funny, legitimately, honestly, truly funny that show still is. Even with jokes that you shouldn't laugh at. There was some episode, who I always loved in The Muppet Show was the band that always kind of looked like the Doobie Brothers. They were all just like these Dr. Teeth and the Medicine Show or whatever they were called. But there was that guitarist whose name I forget, who always looked like a classic rock DJ, and he had like the sunglasses and the long hair and the whatever. But there was some episode where, I forget how this happened, like through some like... spell casting or wizardry or something, like there's something where Miss Piggy like got turned into a statue by like a magician.
Yeah,
like a magician turned her into a statue, turned her into rock. And so I'm watching this episode of The Muppet Show, And like, what's his name from Dr. Teeth just says, now she's afraid that Kermit's going to take her for granted. And it's like, I shouldn't see, and you shouldn't laugh. And yet I just, but it's like, who does that? Who does that joke and sells it? And the answer is someone who loves that kind of comedy and that era of American performance.
Absolutely.
So there you go. Goddamn right. That's Fuck one of those real. Things we ought to just put in like in a satellite and shoot it into space.
It's, yeah.
We are Earth. Here is our Muppet Show.
Yeah. If ever there's an alien species bent on destroying the planet, you know, we can send any kind of tactical or nuclear strike or do what we can to try and mediate a connection between the two. I think if we just offer them the Muppet Show, they'd be like, all right, this one's worth sparing.
Seriously,
think,
like, yeah. Like at the end of the abyss, that's what we show the creatures.
Yeah.
You know, we're good.
This is what we have.
You can find out more about Mr. Big Jim Willig at BigJimWillig.com. That is BigJimWillig, BigJimWillig.com. And that is where you can find all the information about everything happening in Mount Angel. And see, now I don't even know if I should say good luck. I'll just say, you know, like, Godspeed to you.
Just say it'll all be over soon.
It'll all be over soon.
Thank you.
Final thought, Seamus says, the Muppets should do our diplomatic negotiations, like with Iran. Seriously.
Absolutely.
How great would that be if the UN was just, like, if our table at the UN was just the Muppets?
Yeah.
There you go. I can't top that. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milk packing district in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon, at the news desk. It's Big Jim Willigan for Dawn Taylor today. She will return on Monday. So thank you once again for filling in and for Legion of News as well.
Absolutely.
Advanced Technology and Magic, provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, Executive Producer Bruce Hagler, Chief of Staff Cheryl Kanakoa. Don't forget to catch Outlook Portland this coming Sunday, 6:30 a.m. on Cable Channel 3 or on Northwest 32 TV. You can see it at OutlookPortland.com. Our guest will be Stephen Cassell. And be sure to pick up a copy of, now that it is graduation season, a copy of Zombie Economics, which, and I posted this, something about this morning. So it is, as of now, anyway, it looks like the book is currently, I mean, they'll get more and whatnot. Looks like it is, somebody asked about Powell's, it is sold out at the Hawthorne location and the Cedar Hills location,
Sweet.
Beaverton.
Congratulations.
Which, that's good news, bad news. I'd like for people to be able to get it, but yeah, it appears to be people are responding to it. So Zombie Economics is currently sold out at Hawthorne and Cedar Hills Boulevard. A few copies downtown, though. So the Burnside, the main location downtown, and I'm not just saying this, they are kind of going, so you want to kind of you want to get one, but they have some of those downtown. But you can also go online to zombieeconomics.com and you can buy it electronically or have it delivered or whatever. So that's at zombieeconomics.com. zombieeconomics.com. We're gonna have a little encore of both shows today, followed by me going home and then just idly scratching myself throughout the weekend. Have a safe and satisfying weekend. We will see you Monday. Bye now.